Greeting, everybody. I am so excited tonight. This is Daniel from the House of Prayer call, our Thursday night call, which we have regularly, usually about every 2 weeks. I wanted to let you know that I'm super excited about this evening's call because we have six speakers with us tonight. Myself, John, Glenn, Ed, Dave, and Bonnie. And we're going to do our best to keep these presentations in about a half an hour segments so that we won't be too awful long into this evening. Today's date is the 19th of August, 2021, so they say. Our next call will be September 2nd, 2021. I just wanted to let you know about our mission statement, what we do these calls for. This is not your typical Bible study. We are, in fact, warriors in the trenches for freedom. Our mission statement is Isaiah 58:6. That is, loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. Can everybody hear me fine? Let me start with that to make sure. I'm assuming that means yes. I'm going to go ahead and mute some people out that must have come in late that didn't mute their phone out. I'm going to keep doing that during the call when there's extra noise. So I would like you to know about tonight's format. Tonight's format, we're going to have all questions and comments. You need to write them down, so go get you a notepad, piece of paper and pen or pencil, and hold them until after our last speaker, Bonnie, gives her presentation. And then we'll have a free-for-all, your questions and comments. Everybody will have an opportunity. Once again, just please mute out your phone if you can, *6, so I don't have to do it. And sit back with your cup of tea and enjoy the Ministry of Helps brought to you by the House of Prayer. So tonight, my topic is, as you might have seen in the email notice, my topic is citizenship versus nationality. Now, most people think that citizenship and nationality are synonymous terms. They may, in fact, be synonymous if you're only specifically talking about the society known as the United States, because that society is not the nation, as we are going to talk about later on relation to nationality. That society is merely a society. And you may use the word citizen and nationality synonymously there because we're only referring to that society. But let me just give you a quick rundown. I'm going to read from, strangely enough, from me, from Black's Ninth, just so you can know that this is a most current definition of these words as relating to the spell magic book Black's Ninth Dictionary. A citizen is a person who, by either birth or naturalization, is a member of a political community owing allegiance to the community and being entitled to enjoy all its civil rights and protections. A member of the civil state entitled to all its privileges, a CF, which is confer, resident domiciliary. Now, we're going to move down here. It says, for diversity jurisdiction purposes, a corporation that was incorporated within a state or has a principal place of business there is also known as a citizen. Now, nationality, interestingly enough, goes back and it defines itself back to the 17th century, it says. And the first definition is nation. The second definition is the relationship between a citizen of a nation and the nation itself, customarily involving allegiance by the citizen and protection by the state. It's membership in a nation. This term is often used synonymously with citizen. Once again, referring to the United States, I absolutely agree with that on relation to the word citizen and nationality. Now, it was interesting that in the definition in Black's Ninth, it says that on the third definition, it says the formal relationship between between a ship and the nation under whose flag the ship sails. See flag state for nationality. It's a term which has long been used to define the legal relationship between a state and a ship, which is authorized by the state to fly its flag. This is discussions in the International Law Commission in 1951, They reflected concern that the use of the term nationality in reference to ships was misleading, as it implied similarity to the term's use in defining the legal relationship between a state and its citizen. Nonetheless, the term has continued to be the one of the most often employed in describing the relationship between a ship and its flag state. It is important to realize, however, that in spite of their common names, the legal relationship ascribed to the nationality of ships does differ, that arising from the nationality of natural or juridical persons. That's from a book called The Law of the Sea in a Nutshell, a 1984 book. So I'm going to move forward from those definitions, and I try not to be too nerdy with definitions, and try to give you a concept of how I see things. First of all, understand that when we were born here in America, most of us, many of us, the good majority, get what's known as a birth certificate. Now, what is a birth certificate? That is also defined in that Black's Ninth as a formal document that records a person's birth date, birthplace, and parentage. Now, what's interesting about that is there's nothing in that term, in that definition there, that even goes towards citizenship or nationality. I find that it's a blank slate that just defines the birth date, birthplace, and parentage of in a formal document. So here's what I think that I know. The birth certificate is actually, I'm going to go into the world of make-believe here and try to use analogies so I can make a point for you. The birth certificate is a ticket for a boat ride. It's a certificate that we use after reaching the age of majority to get our boat out onto the sea. It is actually your ticket to a boat ride, and you need to think about it that way because it's how you do commerce in international law. If all you have is a ticket for a boat ride, then that's all you have. You have only a person by default that's floating on the sea of commerce, an international ship on the sea, and I am persuaded, and this is how I see things, and that's all we're doing here is we're sharing how we see things in order to help each other. I am persuaded that that particular person is your default person, and the state of are the agency-level agencies that deal with all of the international resident persons, i.e. boat ride citizens, within the territorial boundaries of that particular nation. They are the managing agent for all of those U.S. vessels that have their principal place of origin in the District of Columbia. Now, I don't want to get into great detail tonight, but I did some research on my birth certificate that was given to me, my certificate of beneficial interest, and I found it was issued by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which was a privately owned company that had between 1 and 99 employees. It had a president, was, by the way, not any of the governors or the elected body politic. It actually had a private president, and it was in the business of state executive businesses and state executive functions, and it had its place of business, its headquarters, at 444 North Capitol Boulevard, Washington, D.C., in the Hall of State Building. Now, that is the Hall of State Building is a place where many, not all, but many of the states have their headquarters for this particular functionary state of that I refer to, that your birth certificate is by default gives reference to. So when you are reached the age of majority, there was something that you were required to do if you wanted to have a nationality. I'll get there. So the birth certificate also identifies a legal person, a capacity. You are identified from cradle to grave now as a child, if that's all you have and that's the only person that you embrace. By default, the United States, as a signatory to the Declaration of Human Rights, the Treaty of the... it went through my head. Don't worry about it. I'll come back to that. They're a signatory to that treaty. In that treaty, they define that all people have a right to a person in the eyes of the law. So in keeping with that, your person is that U.S. citizen persona, that vessel on the sea that is created with that birth certificate. Now, you have something else that you can do. I want to let you know that when I was reading on this a number of years ago, in the Immigration and Naturalization Act and the suits and the provision, my ability to get to the law school was not available today, not either locally or online, so I could not find this provision. But while I was reading, the story that was given there was a story of two U.S. citizens that went to France, and while they were in France, they had a baby. And in the story, the international law, the definition of citizenship, conferred over to the child the citizenship of the parents. So the baby that was born was also a citizen of the United States by nature of its parents being a citizen of the United States. But here's where it gets interesting. When that baby reached the age of 18, the age of majority in international law, when it reached 18, it had the ability to elect a nationality. And he could have elected either to be a French national, due to the fact that's where he was born, or he could refer to the nationality of his parents and choose to be a national where his parents were. But that occurred when he was 18. Now, I just want to just pose a hypothetical question. Nobody needs to answer me. How many of you realize that when you reached 18, you had not only the responsibility, but the ability to embrace a nationality? I believe that many, if not most, of the people that I speak to on a regular basis have no record of a nationality on the public record. And in a very short while here in this little monologue I'm going to give you, I'm going to talk to you how I believe that you can establish the record of nationality, thereby not having the boat ride ticket person and, in fact, going on the land. So imagine you're just floating on the ocean like a piece of pond scum floating on the ocean, and you want to get up on land. Well, once you get up on land, by the way, it's very important that you associate with a house. So that's where private membership associations come in, and that's where you actually have the right of association when you're on the land. I will suggest to you that while you're floating on the ocean with your boat ride persona, you are subject to the acts of Congress, and you don't have rights, and all you have is the privilege and immunities that Congress dictates for the persons that they create. That's not a good place to be. You want to have beneficial interest. You want to have the most ability to have beneficial interest, and all of the provisions that were laid down by our forefathers here in this land, and the best way to do that is to embrace a nationality. So, before you're getting annoyed when I'm talking about this U.S. citizen, I just want to let you realize that the Supreme Court has defined in Hooven and Allison versus Evatt that there are three separate and distinct meanings of the term U.S. citizen. The U.S. citizen that I'm referring to, that everyone is concerned with, is the corporate citizen of the International District of Columbia, or District of Criminals, that we all want to separate ourselves from, that have any brains or any common sense to see what's going on out there. But where do you go? What do you do? People say, well, I want to expatriate. Well, it's not going to necessarily be that much better in another land out there. Why not embrace the nationality of the nation you were born in? Those nation states, mine was Pennsylvania. I'm a Pennsylvanian. So I just want to say that before everyone thinks that I'm trying to say birth certificates are intrinsically bad, I want to just throw one thought at you in defense of the possibility that there might be something beneficial to that birth certificate. And I'm not talking about a pot of gold down there that you're going to be able to ream out from the United States, because the last I've seen, they have money incoming. Money outgoing doesn't go very easily. I can look to the first act, an act to provide revenue to the District of Columbia to demonstrate which way the money flows to the United States. But the birth certificate from birth to 18 does equal a share of the beneficial interest in the funds known as the public trust. So if all of the family died all around the little baby, it could be provided for in this beneficial relationship on relationship to that particular certificate of beneficial interest. So at least one good purpose could come out of that certificate, so we don't have to demonize it in all ways. So, like I said, most people wish to separate from the United States citizen. They're doing all kinds of, I'm not this, I'm denouncing that, I'm not that. I believe that the scriptures are a helpful tool in understanding how to deal with governments and man and law here. And it talks about to make our calling and election sure. It doesn't talk about I'm not this. It always talked about the profession, what you elect, and make sure that you make your calling and election sure. So I'm going to ask you, where is your nation? You look in the scripture, you find that Jesus was called Jesus of Nazareth, born in Bethlehem, but interestingly, his nationality was defined as Nazareth. Now, in his day and in the law of his time, and I have not studied why he chose Nazareth versus Bethlehem, maybe there's some people on our comment time that can enlighten me and share that with me. Been in the ministry since 17, but I still am stumped on that one. Maybe y'all can, during the question and answer time, give me the reason why you think he chose Nazareth versus Bethlehem. But then you got Paul of Tarsus. You have in the scriptures the evidence of what I'm referring to, that men were identified with the land. And anyone that says they're in Christ, they had to walk as he walked. On the way to the resurrection, Jesus was known as Jesus of Nazareth. On the way to his resurrection and crucifying the fiction in his crucifixion. That's how Jesus did it. So we talked about going from the seed of the land and from the land into a house, and that's where we go from the sea-based persona, and we get a land-based persona by establishing our nationality. And in that place, we have these houses that we can be part of, these private membership associations. I'm just giving you the big picture there because I only have a short amount of time to speak to you so that you can understand and comprehend that this thing goes much bigger than just making one step. You have protection once you get on the land by your freedom of association, your private membership associations, and that's what you do. I do understand it provides a certain level of protection for those that use U.S. Citizenship personas as well. I'm talking about private membership associations, but nowhere the protection will provide you if you have a nationality. So what I'd like to do right now is read you one of the documents that I created and had some very interesting experience when I placed it in front of the clerk of the Orphans Court, and it was recorded in the clerk of the Orphans Court in February. Hold on, I've got it right here. It was recorded in February 14th, 2020, received by the County of Bucks Orphan Court, which is the probate court in the county where I was born. Things really changed and turned around for me in a very bizarre way that's unexplainable on relation to charges, on relation to government, on relation to warrants, on relation to being incarcerated. It all changed within 7 days of the orphan courts, the probate court, receiving the notice of my election and my nationality. So what I call it, and I will provide this by next week's call, I will provide this documentation because as we're going to go through tonight, our guest speakers are going to have documents and information to share, and they're going to want to be able to give it to the people, the listening audience, on the House of Prayer call. And so if you watch your email when this call is over, between now and the next call, all of this information will be provided to you so that you can make use of it as the ministry of helps that the House of Prayer is. So what I got in front of me, I was incarcerated when this happened. I took some red Skittles, melted them down with a little bit of water, and took some of their nasty toothpaste I wasn't going to brush my teeth with anyway, and I mixed it up and I made a bit of a paste, and I created thumbprints on paper. It took me about a week to collect these things from commissary and trade for some paper so I can do this. And I put my thumbprint, and I called it my seal and my right thumbprint. And what this document is, I'm just going to read it off to you. It says, record and return, stamped, accepted, or received to my name and my address, and no zip code, it says United States of America. This is my notice of calling. This is the heading on this. My notice of calling, election, and allegiance. And in parentheses for explanation, a notice of coming of age and claim of livery of person. Now, if you don't understand those words, that's okay. You can go back and re-listen to this recording. There's a recording playback number that just changed the last number to 9. You can listen to it again. You could, or you take notes. You can look up what livery of person means in the eyes of the law, but that's what this document purported to be. So there's an explanation on this. The explanation says, This is notice to the United States, the Crown, quote, defender of the faith, unquote, the Vatican, quote, vicar of Christ, unquote, and all of the herein oath on relation to, quote, Daniel Joseph, that's my given name, the author, parentheses I, a spiritual peer, and the herein oath of allegiance to the land, the people, and the government of the nation state of Pennsylvania, to be placed in the registry of the people. There's a line, but not a box. There's a line in it. The author, I, the offspring of holy wedlock of native Connecticuter Edward Francis Lichtag and native Connecticuter Helen Coppola, born on the soil of Bristol, Pennsylvania, Bucks County, as a spiritual peer, prays. My father, parentheses, Lichtag, he art in heaven. Hallowed be my name. My kingdom come, my will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give me this day my daily bread, and forgive me my debts as I forgive my debtors, and lead me not into temptation, but deliver me from evil. For mine is the kingdom, the power, the glory forever. Then there's another short line, just for separation's sake, not a box. And there's my oath. It says, oath. The author, parentheses I, do solemnly declare my oath of allegiance to the Almighty Creator and to the land, people, and his government in and of Pennsylvania, a united state, united in the Articles of Confederation, parentheses, one of the four organic laws of the United States of America, end parentheses. The author herewith makes record of his coming of age and of his repudiation, rejection, and renouncing of the person of the child, it's in brackets, the word child, then I list the full name that's on the birth certificate, and then I list the Social Security number there, then I list the date of birth there, which is on file with the Pennsylvania Department of Vital Statistics, file number, and I list the file number on that birth certificate there. The author elects to be a native Pennsylvanian. The author, I, declare under penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America that the foregoing is true and correct, executed on February 2nd, 2020 AD, and I put down there by Daniel Joseph. Now, that's the document that caused an amazing major shift in the way I have been treated by the people that are responsible for the boat ride ticket entities, the residents within their land. Interestingly, I sent that document to about 15 or 16 high contracting parties. None of the lower court people or personnel received this. Just the high contracting parties, the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, Department of State. But interestingly, I sent one to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania Secretary of State, and I got a letter back from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Governor's Office of General Counsel, the Department of State Office of Chief Counsel, also received about 7 days later. And its subject is Notice of Calling Election and Allegiance, a Notice of Coming of Age and Claim of Livery of Person. And it sent it to myself, and of course it put it into a zip code there, although nowhere in any of my documents or mailing was a zone improvement plan number ever used. But I thought you might interestingly appreciate this letter, and maybe you can extrapolate, like I did, some conjecture about the meaning of this. This letter said, this is in response to correspondence mailed to Secretary of State. This document was forwarded to the Office of Chief Counsel of the Pennsylvania Department of State for a response. Be advised that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and or the Secretary of the Commonwealth is not in any way associated with the documents that you forwarded. The mailing of your document to the Secretary of State has no legal effect. I thought that was interesting. Nor is any notice taken of the statements made within the documents. In bold, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and the Secretary of the Commonwealth do not agree to any of the terms and conditions in your mailing and specifically deny all your enumerated claims. Well, we're going to hear about the right of self-determination, but I just thought that was really interesting. There's more. The secretary is not in any way bound by the receipt of or the content in this document. This office specifically rejects the premise that any document is now a public record as a result of your mailing. The Office of the Secretary also rejects the concept that failure to respond to your document constitutes notice of or the admission of any of the statements within said document. Accordingly, your original correspondence will be destroyed. Thank you for your attention to this matter. This office anticipates that this is the last correspondence it will receive from you about the subject matter. And of course, it is not signed, not even robo-signed, not even commerce-signed with a commercial signature. That's the way the letter ends. I just thought that was a hooch. I'm thinking to myself, I obviously have hit a nerve. So, in summarization, because I have a lot of speakers tonight, a nationality in a nation is essential to, one, having a different person than the boat ride person, a land-based person, and two, the state of no longer is the guardian of your person, because the person that you embrace when you have a nationality is not BC-based. I encourage everybody to do some form of election. If you are there and you have no record that you have embraced a nationality and you've elected to be, people are saying, oh, I just want to know what it's going to take to be a state citizen. Well, you know what? It's not in telling them what you're not. You can send 10,000 whiny letters telling them what you're not. It's about what you've elected. And I'm encouraging everybody, especially in these times, to protect yourselves from the edicts of being a congressional person in the area where you live and embrace a nationality and get enrolled as a member of a nation that you were born in. Now, I did pretty good because I started the call, and I did my beginnings, and I did my monologue, and I did it all in under 30 minutes. I'm so proud of myself, and I just jammed right along there. So if you have any questions, hold them to the end, and I'm just going to go ahead and give my voice a rest and turn the call over to our next speaker, John. Welcome, John.
Hey, guy, that was good. While you were doing that, I just happened to have Black's Third in front of me. I was going to quote some stuff from it, so I flipped over and I looked up livery. And one of the definitions says, a writ, which may be sued out by a ward in chivalry on reaching his majority to obtain delivery of the possession of his lands out of the hands of the guardian. So it looks to me like he did the exact right thing. The livery and chivalry in feudal law, the delivery of the lands of a ward in chivalry out of the guardian's hands upon the heirs attaining the requisite age, 21 for males, 16 for females. So anyway, you you was right on that, buddy. That is the word. So what I'm going to do now is talk about another word. It's a word that we all love. It gets thrown at us all the time. And the word is frivolous. Every time we, anybody that's got any experience dealing with the government or in any kind of court or anything like that, we're used to getting responses saying we're frivolous. So a friend of mine did a little looking that up, and come to find out, the word frivolous is a legal term, and it goes way back there. Now, I'm looking in Black's Third, and the definition of frivolous is an answer or other pleading is called frivolous when it is clearly insufficient on its face and does not controvert the material points of the opposite pleading, and is presumably interposed for mere purpose of delay or to embarrass the opponent. And it goes further down there, and it cites about 20 cases right there. It goes on further and says, a frivolous demur has been defined to be one which is so clearly untenable or its insufficiency so manifest upon a bare inspection of the pleadings that its character may be determined without argument or research. So it has some other terms, and it says under synonyms, it says the term frivolous and sham as applied to the pleadings do not mean the same thing. A sham pleading is good on its face, but false in fact. It may, to all appearances, constitute a perfect defense, but is a pretense because it's false and because not pled in good faith. A frivolous plea may be perfectly true in its allegations, but yet is liable to be stricken out because totally insufficient in substance. And there's a few cases for that. So what they're saying is when we put something in that they can't overcome, overcome with law, I'll say, or cases or anything like that, then the government comes back when they can't cite any law or anything like that to overcome our pleading. They just call us names, or they call our pleading names. So it's frivolous. Well, in all states, there's mechanisms in place for doing away with false and fictitious pleadings and sham pleadings. Every state has one. The interesting thing is hardly anybody goes in and has a pleading done away with. In the cases that I've looked up, the ones that usually got in trouble for that was the judges. So they would do away with a plea and because of being frivolous or sham or whatever, and then that decision would get taken up. And they get overturned for some reason or something like that. So the judges don't really strike things much. They do every now and then, but not much. But our deal from this investigation would allow us to ask the court to strike the opponent's pleading if it doesn't controvert what we put in. If we put in a pleading and the government comes back like they always do and they want to talk about something totally different and call our pleading frivolous and all that stuff, then now that we know that frivolous is a legal term, then because their pleading doesn't address our pleading, then their pleading is frivolous. So we can put the shoe on the other foot. And then also, let's see here. I got a court case I want to read right here on the computer. Stand by. It went to sleep. Wake up. I'm on there. All right. Stand by here. I hope my computer didn't go dead on me. Oh, there it is. All right, this case is, it's an old case. A lot of these cases are really old. This is a 1923 case. 98 NJL 845. It's out of New Jersey. June 18th, 1923, it's Skullthroat versus the Commonwealth Casualty Company. So they're arguing about, it was a jitney, they call them, which is a taxi cab, had insurance, and so they're arguing about all that stuff. And so they get in here and they start talking about what they call these cases. So it says, while the courts sometimes use the terms frivolous and sham as meaning the same thing, and a motion to strike is often based on the ground that a plea is both frivolous and sham.
There is nevertheless a clear distinction between the two, in that a sham plea is good on its face, but false in fact, while a frivolous plea is one which is on its face, sets up no defense, although it may be true. A frivolous pleading is always assumed to be true, while a sham pleading must be admitted or conclusively proved to be false. The character of the former is determined by mere inspection, while that of the latter is usually determined by proof. So, also, Mr. Justice, whatever, speaking for the court, in an opinion filed April 20 of the present year and not yet officially reported, called attention to the same distinction, and after pointing out fraudulent nature of a sham plea at common law, is that it is palpably or inherently false, and from the plain or concealed facts in the case must have been known to the party interposing it to be false. Stated as to frivolous plea, common law, quoting from Bouvier, that it, quote, need not be false, but is palpably insufficient as a legal defense to the action, and hence legally unsubstantial or frivolous, and therefore presumably interposed for the purpose of delay. So, now then that we know what frivolous is and how it should be applied, we'll be able to respond to the to any type of letters or pleadings or anything like that attack us as frivolous, because we put in a complaint and then they come back and say it's frivolous, then they have a problem, because for it to be frivolous, it has to be off point, pure BS, not a defense, all these things. So if they come and attack us as frivolous, and they don't say anything about attacking our pleading, they don't attack our legal argument or anything like that, then the truth is their pleading is frivolous. So anyway, that's the results of this little bit of research. Now, when you look at how this might apply, just think about this. For example, you get a ticket, and on the ticket, they identify your automobile as a vehicle. Well, we know what it takes to be a vehicle. For it to be a vehicle, it has to be insured, it has to be inspected, it has to be driven by a licensed person, it has to be registered, and all these different things before it's a vehicle. Now, if they stop and give you a ticket for no registration or no driver's license or anything like that, and then they identify it as a vehicle, their document that they're going to submit on their claim is false on its face, because it can't be a vehicle if it doesn't have registration or driven by a licensed person and all that stuff. So you could actually have an evidentiary hearing to prove that their evidence was false. So anyway, and if it's false on its face, then it's a sham pleading. Their evidence is a sham. So I think you make some of these traffic things pretty short order if we start utilizing the words that they're using against us. We know what they mean or learn what they mean and utilize it against them. So that's all I've got. It's just a little short thing today, but I thought it was a really interesting word when I got to digging into it. Nearly every state that I looked at or know of, and the federal government, has procedure in there for handling documents that are untrue and all that stuff. Everybody's got procedures for that. So when we are able to identify these documents that are contrary to what the rules are, everything, then we can have those documents stricken. We can have parts of them stricken. We can call for sanctions. We can do all kinds of things. So when they start throwing that frivolous word around, they're sticking their chin out for somebody to slap it. So anyway,
that's my deal for the day, and y'all have a good rest of the call.
Thank you, John. I hope you're staying on to the end, because you raised two questions, but I'm going to keep my own rules and keep them till after the end, because you raised two questions that I think one will be helpful and one I definitely want to know. So I appreciate you sharing with us. The next speaker that we have on the lineup, keeping things moving right along here, is Glenn from the House of Fern. Are you around, Glenn? I know
yes,
you're there.
I am.
All right. Well, greetings, Glenn. I'm going to let you introduce your topic that was in the email and let you get right on with it in the interest of time. Welcome to the House of Prayer Call, Glenn. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. my topic is about bar grievances and judicial complaints. I have found them to be very effective. In Texas, the State Commission on Judicial Conduct has 12 members. Under the statutes, they're supposed to have seven to have a quorum. And I went and sent a letter, a public information request to the Secretary of State, and asked for the 12 members' oaths of office. And the Secretary of State sent me back 5 oaths of office. So that means the other 7 were impersonating public servants. So, and 6 of those 7 were bar members. So, the State Commission on Judicial Conduct in Texas, I think they're corrupt, but I did file bar grievances against the 6 members on the Texas State Commission on Judicial Conduct, because, again, you have to understand that bar members are the low-hanging fruit. They're the ones that are the easiest to go after. They're the ones that have an oath of office, and the courts have said that they are deemed to know the law. And so when that city cop violates your rights, if you sue him, there's a bar member going to step in and defend him. And so you file bar grievances against the lawyers, and I have found it to have very good results. They don't want to talk to me. It's amazing how that works. The reason is that I bring up all the felonies they're involved in, okay? Multiple felonies. Suborning perjury, for example. You know, that cop is perjuring his oath of office. If you have one of their show trials, that cop is going to perjure his oath of office, and those bar members know it. And so they're suborning perjury. That's a felony. There's a bunch of them. There's war crimes. There's impersonating public servants. How about 18 U.S.C. Section 4, misprison of felony? They're not reporting the felonies that are going on. Anyways, what I did is I developed it's a Word file with the bar grievance form in Texas. The form is 6 pages. And the last page and a half is 7 pages. The last page and a half, or the second, the last page is you sign it. The 2 pages before that are for the actual text of the bar grievance. And I've gotten to the point now that I just made a Word file and I print it over top. And And what I do also, they used to send my bar grievances back saying that this is not a violation of the Code of Ethics. They always send a copy to the bar member. So a lot of times that alone accomplishes it. But now what I do, and since I've been doing this, they rarely send it back to me, which means they're investigating it. Anyways, what I do, Texas statutes say that if you're going to file a criminal complaint, it has to start off in the name and by the authority of the state of Texas. So I put that up at the front. And then I go on and I say, as a direct descendant of the founders of the Constitution for the United States of America and as one of the posterity found in the preamble, by right of blood, I hereby declare. And then I'll use the bar member's name as an officer of the court and deemed to know the law. Paragraph 2. The bar member is, in this case, this is one I filed a bar grievance against a assistant district attorney. And so they're an assistant district attorney and work for the Tarrant County District Attorney. And then all you have to do for any criminal complaint in Texas, and I think it's probably the same elsewhere, is I have reason to believe and do believe that this bar member intends to suborn perjury by her Bedford Military Police and their police court. You know, I was looking in their statutes, the ones that are actually passed by the legislature, and they always call these municipal courts, they call them police courts. And so, and they're all military police, too. They don't call them military police, but they are. They all use military rank structures. It's all because of the martial law. And Federal Reserve notes, another name for Federal Reserve notes is military script. So this gives me all sorts of juicy stuff to put in there. So anyways, intends to suborn perjury by her Bedford Military Police and her police court and her bar member's offices of their police court in violation of 18 U.S.C. 1622. Because she's required to know that no police in Tarrant County are authorized to enforce the Texas Transportation Code as required by Section 701 of the Texas Transportation Code. And that's true. The only people that can enforce the Transportation Code in Texas are Highway Patrol or someone. There's in each county, they can appoint five. But and if the county has, like, a whole bunch of people in it, like more than a million, then they can appoint two more, and that's it. And they have to be riding motorcycles, and they have to be on county payroll. And there's a bunch of requirements, and I think that's why they don't do it, because it's too much hassle. Anyways, so if some cop stops you for speeding, well, that's in the transportation code. And so he's official oppression. He's engaging in official oppression. These bar members know that's exactly what's going on, and so I bar grieve them. Matter of fact, when I get, you know, they don't even stop me anymore, quite frankly, but I do help other people, and if they get a speeding ticket, that's what we do, is we'll bar grieve the prosecutor, then we'll bar grieve the city attorney, and 9 times out of 10, the city attorney works for a law firm. And think about it, that law firm, all of those partners in that law firm are profiting from this cop going out and perjuring his oath of office and engaging in official oppression and all of this stuff, right? So I bar grieve all the partners in the law firm. So a lot of times I'll have like 6 or 7 bar members I file bar grievances against. And they're doing more than just suborning perjury. Official oppression, okay, under Texas Penal Code, that's violating somebody's rights under the color of law. And essentially under in Texas, okay? And then there's other stuff. They're engaged in, I tell them, I say this bar member intends that the Lake Worth Military Police and their Azle Military Police and their Euless Military Police and their Bedford Military Police and their North Richland Hills, these are all police departments I've dealt with in the past, and their Colleyville Military Police and their Grapevine Military Police and their Fort Worth Military Police, and they're bought and paid for police courts, be a criminal street gang under Texas Penal Code Section 7101. And they intend to perjure their oath of office by bringing District of Columbia military dictatorship territorial codes on the land of Texas. That's what you have to understand, is that they're all U.S. citizens. They're all foreigners in Texas. And the same thing in every other state. Okay, so that's a violation of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, because it says Congress can only make those kinds of laws for 10 miles max. District of Columbia, 10 square miles max. And so they're perjuring their oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, which is the supreme law of the land under Article 6, Clause 2. And in violation of Texas Penal Code 37.02, which is perjury of oath. And then, so I actually have 17 pages of criminal felonies. Not all of them are felonies. Some of them are serious misdemeanors that I accuse these bar members of. And every one of them starts off, I have reason to believe and do believe. and then I go through and I tell them, call them their military police, intend to subject me to the deprivation of my right. And you got to use their words, okay, and their codes. Everything's martial law. And under martial law, there is no law. So the only laws are laws that they pass and their codes. So you have to use their words. So I use their words. And subject me to the deprivation of my right to travel and my right to be left alone under color of their District of Columbia military dictatorship codes and their color of law warrants that are actually KPSs, and that's true in Texas. There's very few actual warrants that are ever issued. It's always a KPS, or almost always a KPS. I haven't ever seen a real warrant. Anyways, a KPS, the courts have ruled that a KPS is not a warrant. And a KPS is a, this, it's actually, a KPS is a bench warrant is what it is, but it's not a real warrant. It's a color of law warrant. And it's actually a debt instrument. So they're creating debt instruments. And so there's some more felonies going on there. How about forgery? Okay, forging your signature onto a document so they can issue their debt instrument. Okay, it's actually, it's a quasi-contract. Don't get me going. You're going to get me going here. Anyways, under their District of Columbia military dictatorship codes and their color of law warrants that are actually KPSs, they fail to be warrants in violation of 18 U.S.C. 242. And that's violating somebody's rights under the color of law. And then I say that they're conspiring together, which is a violation of 18 U.S.C. 241. And then they're subjecting me, think about it, these civil courts, there's a maxim of civil law that says let he who is willing to be deceived be deceived. So they lie, they cheat, they steal. So it's really a satanic religious ceremony. Their court, their kangaroo court, their police court, okay? So I have reason to believe that this bar member intends to subject me to her Lake Worth Military Police Court and her Azle Military Police Court and her Euless Military Police Court and her Bedford Military Police Court and her North Richland Hills Military Police Court. I list all these cities with their military police courts, with their satanic religious ceremony, with their Roman law and their fake money that's actually military script, and their fraud and their lies and their deception and their perjury of oath that they love to do, and their treason and sedition in violation of 18 U.S.C. 247. Okay, that's subjecting someone to a satanic or a religious, depriving you of your religious freedom is essentially, if you read it, it's what it's all about. And then I'm involved with the Republic of Texas, so I go after them for because Republic of Texas is foreign to the state of Texas, and so international law comes into play. So their threats of arrest with their fake warrants through the mail of a protected person under international law in violation of 18 U.S.C. 878. There's a whole bunch of paragraphs. I don't know if you want to go through them all. Anyways, what happens is they used to send them back to me, okay? Even when they were sending them back to me, you know, those bar members, like I filed a lawsuit and against one of the cities because they assaulted me. And they had this lawyer that showed up, and he basically was just dumping on me. And so I filed a bar grievance on him, and I haven't heard a peep out of his butt since then. Not a peep. Because you have to understand that these lawyers do not get due process when it comes to the bar. There is no such thing as due process for lawyers. They're deemed to know the law. They're required to know the law. And they do not get due process. The bar just does whatever they're going to do. The bar is run by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court knows the law. Matter of fact, if the bar starts doing something that I don't like, then I send a nasty gram to the Chief Judge of the Supreme Court. And, so they do not get due process. These bar members are scared to death of the bar. I know some bar members that got disbarred, and they just make it up, the bar does. So if you're filing grievances against them, also another thing is that I hear, I don't know for sure, but I hear that if they get three bar grievances, I heard that if a new lawyer like in his first year, gets a bar grievance, he loses his bond right away, right off the bat, because they have a private company that provides their insurance, and so the private company is really what makes the decision. So then what I'll do, what I've also heard is that if a law firm gets 5 bar grievances, the law firm loses its bond. So then they have to shut it down and start up a new one. If a bar member gets 3 bar grievances, then he loses his bond. Now, that's what I've heard. I don't know for sure. I haven't been able to verify it. But, you know, you get enough people filing bar grievances, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And I have found these bar grievances to be very powerful. Matter of fact, there's a bunch of them that I've sent recently that they haven't sent back to me. I haven't heard a peep out of them. And so what that tells me is they're investigating it, okay? Number one, one of the things I do is I accuse the bar member under 18 U.S.C. Section 4, which misprison of felony, which means they're a bar member, they're officer of the court, they're required to know the law. If they know of a felony, they're supposed to report it. And so he's failing to report the felonies. Well, and that's basically a hint to the bar, because if I'm bringing in some allegations of these felonies against these bar members, and then what I'll do is some of these bar grievances might have like 150 pages or more, because I'll attach a bunch of evidence, okay, of cases that I'm in that that I'll have as evidence that I can use against them. And that's all evidence. And so it really, you know, I'm hoping that I get some bar members disbarred. You know, that'll send shudders through the bar. I guess we'll see what happens. But anyways, so I bring up one of the things is seditious conspiracy under 18 U.S.C. 2384, piracy under 18 U.S.C. 1652, okay, because they're pirates, okay, that's exactly what they are, and then accomplices after the fact under 18 U.S.C. 3, and we already talked about 18 U.S.C. 4, sending threats, you know, these bar members send little letters out saying, you got a warrant out for you. Well, that's a threatening letter, okay, and that's a felony too, 18 U.S.C. 876, and it's really not a warrant, okay, so that's all the more reason why it's a threat. And then there is also, I throw in some more stuff about suborning perjury, war crimes, okay. If they steal something but me or force or tow my car and force me to pay money to get it back, well, that's pillaging, okay? Pillaging and under the Geneva Convention, okay? And Texas is under military occupation, has been since 1862. And so that's a war crime under 18 U.S.C. 2441. And then they stole my homemade Republic of Texas plate. Which is another war crime, pillaging, and taking reprisals against me for my political beliefs. That's another war crime, 18 U.S.C. 2441. I throw in stuff about force-feeding me in their jail, force-feeding me poisons with their dead pig and their chemicals and their fake vaccines for their fake COVID-19 vaccination, experimental vaccinations, which is... a biological warfare agent in violation of the Geneva Convention, Article 32 and 18 U.S.C. 2441. And then their criminal racketeering enterprise under 18 U.S.C. 1951 to 1968. I mean, this thing is like 17 pages of this stuff. Eh? I mean, I just dump on them. And a lot of times I'll be thinking about, oh, there's some good ones here. Forgery, forging my signature. Selling me into slavery with their fake warrant to Capius, which is a debt instrument under 17 CFR 240.15 C2-12, which is, that's talking about the, I'll think about it in a minute, about the, they have to give you a certificate of participation, okay, which means their bonds. They have to tell you what their bonds are. And so they're making a debt instrument. It's a quasi-contract is what it is. And so then they're forging my signature onto a quasi-contract under their Texas Business and Commerce Code, their private international law, Texas Business and Commerce Code 3.308 and 8.114, with the objective of stealing money out of the SESTA K trust account under the Convention Concerning the International Administration of the States of Deceased Persons, which was concluded on the 2nd of October, 1972, and the Convention on the Law of Applicable to Trusts and Their Recognition, which was concluded on the 1st of July, 1985, during the Hague Conference on Private International Law, and in violation of Texas Penal Code 32.21. Okay, so they forged my signature onto a contract. They're engaging in a simulated legal process under Texas Penal Code 32.48. They're, and then the SESTA K Trust is created under 31 Stat 1432 that creates the SESTA K Trust. I mean, I could just go on. There's like 17 pages of this stuff. So, you know, they haven't sent too many back lately. And I know I've been hitting some hot buttons. Suborning perjury is one alone. That these lawyers, and they do it all the time, and they know that that's what's going on. They're officers of the court. They're required to know. And so I really like doing bar members. I'll be glad to send anybody that wants the text of my bar grievance. I've got a YouTube channel, Sovereign Living, and you can go there. And at the bottom of my recent videos, you'll find links to my recent bar grievances. And you'll see how I set them up. And the files are quite large, so they're too big to email because of the attachments. So it's links to Google Docs is what they are. But you can go ahead and look at them. And really the important stuff is like about the first 20 or 30 pages at the most. And the rest of it's attachments. And so all you need to do is look at the front part and see how I put the thing together. And because I tell them in the bar grievance form, they want to know a title, and I write down no titles. An address is no zip code exempt. I put a bunch of stuff in there. I don't, because they have lots of traps in there where they're trying to trap you. And so I put all that stuff in there. You'll see how I do that. I would encourage you to do the same if you're concerned about that kind of stuff. Aggravated assault, when that cop comes up with his gun, that's aggravated assault. I mean, I just go on and on. And then at the very end, okay, any criminal complaint, I do it in Texas and I do it in other states, it says in the beginning it has to say in the name and by the authority of the state of Texas, and at the very end it has to say against the peace and dignity of the state. And so then I list all these grievances. I incorporate at the last paragraph, I talk about the whatever I'm attaching, so all of which is evidenced in the notice of void judgment, which was filed into the Euless Police Court on or about the 20th of January, 2020, and the email response to the public information request from the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office that says that they don't use traffic officers in Tarrant County. True copies of each of which are attached here to all of each of which are incorporated herein by reference in their entirety. Anyways, I have found bar grievances to be very powerful. And I think that once I get the State Commission on Judicial Conduct operating properly, I think they'll be pretty good too. I have heard, and again, this is something I've heard, I don't know for sure, but I have heard, because I went and I sent some nasty grams to some judges, and when I send my nasty gram, I start off, you know, normally I send out a notice and demand, and I say, accept your oath of office. If you think you're representing me, you're fired. If you... You know, it's like about 20 pages, and I just go through and defeat all their presumptions. Anyways, once in a while I'll send out a nasty gram to a judge that I've sent him the notice and demand, so he knows exactly what he's doing, and I got proof of it. And so then I'll send him one of my nasty grams, and it'll say, normally I say I accept your oath of office, but you and I both know you have no intention of honoring your oath of office, so, and that's when I start using four-letter words. I won't say all the four-letter words I'm using here. But it's screw your oath, you MFSOB. And then if you or your pigs want a piece of me, you just name a date, time, and location. I'll come armed. We'll settle it for once and for all, you MFSOB. I know you would never take me up on that because you're cowards. The first thing you want to do is disarm, make sure I'm unarmed, you MFSOB. And so, anyways, when I send those things out, it's like 20 pages of that. Anyways, when I send it out at the very beginning, I make sure and copy in, like when Trump was in, I copy in. The judge, one would go to the judge, then there'd be one going to judge, one would be going to the attorney general, one would be going to the FBI, one would be going to the Texas State Police. You know, there'd be about six people up there that are getting it. And so I have heard, and I don't know how true this is, I have heard that Trump told Abbott, who's the governor of Texas currently, that he's got to get his court straightened out, and he certainly does, because there's lots of corruption in the court in Texas, and I build a case of, and, you know, Trump, I'm positive he reads my stuff. You know, I went and filed a criminal complaint against Jeff Sessions, and Trump came out, and I sent Trump a copy. Trump came out and started bad-mouthing Jeff Sessions. I filed a criminal complaint against Kirstjen Nielsen, the Secretary of Homeland Security. Trump came out and started bad-mouthing Kirstjen Nielsen. It's amazing. Anyways, I guess that's about it, the end for me. If anybody has, they can send me an email. My email address is engineerwin@yahoo.com. And I'll send you a copy of the text if you want. I've got a couple private groups at Yahoo and Google called Administrating, not Yahoo. It's called Freelist. Actually, it's Freelist now. The Yahoo ones got deleted. They're called Administering Your Public Servants. So you can go there and network with a bunch of like-minded people if you want. And my YouTube channel is Sovereign Living, all one word. And there's a bunch of them now. They didn't used to be, but the one that's got the scales of justice is mine. And so there's a bunch of them. The one with the scales of justice is mine. And you can go watch some of my videos, and you can get some of those bar grievances and look them over. Anyways, I think that these bar grievances is always any problem you have. I don't care what kind of problem you're having. There's always a bar member behind it. I filed bar grievances against Google, the chief counsel for Google, and I actually found about three or four bar members that are working for Google, so I filed bar grievances against them. I got a bar grievance in my computer right now that I got to print and send off that's against the chief counsel for Microsoft. I mean, I don't care what kind of problem you're having. There's always, always, always a bar member behind it. And so they're the low-hanging fruit. They have an oath of office. They're presumed to know the law. Go for the juggler. That's my attitude. And I don't give them a chance, okay? I build a case against them, and I go for the juggler. I don't give them a chance at all. I sandbag them is what I do. And they're not – if you go in and you give them a chance – they'll just badmouth you. That's exactly what they do. I've seen it happen to other people. And so Randy Kelton, Rule of Law Radio, said to do that, and I agree with him 100%. And so I guess that's about it for me and bar grievances.
Well, thank you so much, Glenn. Take a breath now. Later on in question and answers, you raised the question for me. I'll hit you then, too. We're doing pretty good on time. And the next speaker is our local barrel-chested Ed. I could do that to him because he said that first, by the way. He told us he was barrel-chested. Ed, are you there and are you ready?
I am.
Come on, tell me the truth. Tell the audience the truth. You told me you were barrel-chested first before I called names.
Oh, yeah, I wish I had a nickel for every time some sheriff's deputy come up and tap me on the shoulder and said you're talking too loud in court.
Well, Ed, I'm going to give the floor to you, and it's all okay. You tonight, brother. I'm glad you're here.
Okay, thank you. I've got a treat for the group tonight, but first I'm going to say a word about Glenn. Glenn got me started probably 4 or 5 years ago. I was watching his channel on YouTube, and it's a really interesting channel. He goes over a lot of things. A lot of people know that I bought my land with gold last year and that you can't tax anything on gold, so I've got a big property tax battle going on in my county right now in Georgia. But I studied Glenn's videos, and also he has something, when you look on his channel, if you go look at it, he's got something called a Form 1020, which I used for years. Glenn probably doesn't even know who I am, but I was a guy that was always sending him videos of me in court fighting it out, duking it out with the judges and attorneys all over the nation, probably 3 or 4 years ago. But what he was saying was spot on. Our issue is we have a state bar attorney between every financial transaction on the planet today. You can't find a member in Congress that isn't a state bar association member. But I want to share something with the group. I want to share two things, and then I've got a surprise for everybody. So the first thing is the client-attorney agreement, and some on the channel have heard this, and I imagine some might not have, but John, who spoke before Glenn, and I put together a client-attorney agreement, and through my partner, Chris, up in New York, where we do child support enforcement actions, we probably served close to 800 of these agreements through our clients since we came up with this last year. And essentially, it's just one paragraph, and this is what it says. Client attorney agreement. As my counsel, by your signature, you agree and pledge your bond that in all transactions in this matter, you will not waive nor allow me to intentionally waive or forfeit any of my political or legal constitutional protections, or allow me to enter into any agreements, implied or expressed, that would waive or forfeit any of my political or legal constitutional protections. And further, you agree to inform me of any presumptions that the court could make that could cause me to waive or forfeit any of my political or legal constitutional protections. Please file this agreement into the record after signing to make the judge and court aware of its existence in this matter before the court. At least 800 of these have been served, and we haven't had a single attorney that will sign it. And there's probably one girl on here right now that served about 95 of them in her county, called the State Bar Association when she couldn't find someone to represent her, and they wouldn't help her either, saying it was up to the individual attorneys. But the reason they can't sign this, folks, is because when you walk into that courtroom, you've already waived your rights, and all the attorneys know that, so they can't protect your rights. They're not there to do that. They're there to protect the state. So anybody that wants a copy of that client attorney agreement, what we do is we get on the state bar, you know, whatever state you live in, we get on their website, and we just start emailing state bar attorneys saying we've got a matter. And money is no object, and we'd be happy to pay them double their retainer. Just sign the client-attorney agreement, file it into the record, and tell me where to send your retainer. And we can't get a single state bar attorney to sign it. So we're exposing the fraud before we actually get into court. So that's one thing. The second thing I'm going to share with the group, Ron Howard Kelly started Oracle Database Systems back in, early to late 80s. And he put together a declaration of status in fraud and then shared it with me through the State Assembly, Association of State Assemblies, and then asked me to fill in the gaps. And so we put this thing together. It's 62 pages of the best timeline of fraud that I've ever seen for corporate government. And it goes all the way back to before the Civil War, when all this corruption started. Anyway, I made that available to the Daniel, and anybody that wants a copy of it. The cool thing about this declaration, a lot of people know this, but a declaration, if not contested in a timely manner, is considered undisputed facts as a matter of law. And what we do is we use the administrative process with this declaration of status in fraud, where we file it into the record, and then if they don't answer in a certain amount of time, we file a notice of default and opportunity to cure, and then after that we file a final default and then send them a true bill. And you will get the judgment if they don't answer. And see, they can't answer this because it's 312 points over 62 pages of fraud that they can't disprove. So that's available to everybody on the group tonight. That's really all I'm going to say about it. That brings me to my third surprise. I have my partner actually on the phone tonight with us that wants to share something important in the same vein as what the I and the other guys are talking about. Chris, are you out there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here. Yes.
Okay. Folks, this is my partner and one of the smartest guys in the room. His name is Chris. He owns a YouTube channel called Child Support Made Simple. We've been working together for a little over a year now, and we've been kicking butt in the basically the whole corrupt child support and child protective service industry. And Chris, I'm going to give you the floor so you can tell. We've got about, from my watch, we've got about 18 minutes. So somewhere around 9 p.m. Eastern, we should be wrapping it up. So go ahead.
Sure, sure. Thanks for having me, everyone. As Ed says, yes, we work basically with child support industry, which is a $58 billion industry across all 50 states. The number of families are involved in about 14 million families. The agency, it's run mostly by lawyers. There are no accountants in the child support industry. There's no forensic anything. It's just run by lawyers. And all they do is basically force men into the child support program, and then the federal government turns around and gives them 66 cents on the dollar for every dollar they collect. And just to put that in perspective, for every dollar that they spend, they pocket $5 in profit. That just goes to them. So that's what we're up against. But tonight, one of the things that we Ed and I have been talking about for a while is the role of attorney when you hire an attorney. When you hire an attorney, you do give up your rights. In fact, the one right you give up is your Fifth and your Sixth Amendment right, and most people don't know that. There's a case law called Carlson v. Carlson out of Georgia. I forgot the year it was decided, but a woman that was charged with contempt, and the decision was her attorney didn't give her her rights or told her of her rights. And so the three-judge panel, again, this is an appellate court decision, right, the top court, they came out with basically very simple explanation. When you hire an attorney, we are presuming that he or she tells you of all of your rights. If they do not, we as the judges cannot ask you if you're aware of your rights, nor can we even listen to it. And even after we discovered that your attorney did not basically demonstrate your rights, it's not available on appeal. And again, that's a top Georgia appellate court decision. So let's break it down basically. So let's say you committed whatever, not a crime, but something infraction, and you could have pled the Fifth. If your attorney didn't tell you that you could and you didn't, you can't use it on appeal, which goes against the whole reason for an appeal. So what the bottom line is this. When you hire an attorney, you are worse off than if you walked in there not knowing anything about the law, because you could always hold on to your Fifth and your Sixth Amendment rights. When you hire an attorney, all of those goes away. The first thing is your Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel goes away. So you could get a real, I call, bottom of the barrel law school student. Hello? Hello?
Yeah, I just muted that. I muted that party out. Some people don't know how to use the mute button yet, Chris. I'm so sorry. Keep going, please.
That's all right, yeah. So you could get the bottom of the barrel law school student, not even a lawyer, a law school student who's unaware of the law, did not tell you certain rights that you still possess, and you waive those rights, then you have no appeal. You can't then, what they call, put those back on the books. So if you didn't plead the Fifth, you lost your Sixth, your Seventh and your Eighth just goes right out the door, which is your jury trial. You can't file an appeal and say, hey, my attorney didn't inform me of these rights, therefore I'd like to restore them. Nope. You've lost them. So now the question is, why would you hire an attorney? Well, that's the biggest question. The answer is, you wouldn't, because you end up losing more than if you don't hire one. because at least the judge can entertain you directly by asking you your rights. Did you get the right to effective assistance of counsel? You can always say yes or no, and in our world, we use our client attorney agreement, which shuts up our judges because nobody will sign them, so that's a good thing. Next is your Fifth Amendment. You can always say, Your Honor, I don't understand, and you can hold on to that all the way through conviction. So the moral of it is when Ed and I found this case law, we were shocked. I mean, we couldn't believe that that was the answer, that if you hire an attorney and he's not the best or he doesn't know anything, there is nothing the judges will do to restore your Bill of Rights. It is completely waived. And that is scary. And that's something I would not put on my YouTube channel because YouTube would shut me down in a minute because 25% of YouTube revenues is from the Bar Association, all the lawyers between family law. And I put that out there that is makes no sense hiring an attorney. I could see a black, almost like a sucking sound in YouTube advertising, and they would pull my plug as the day begins because – they don't want to know this, but this is real serious. So that's one thing. The second thing is capias warrants. Many of you probably heard of them, and they're issued by every layer. Most of capias warrants, they're all signed by deputy clerks. Now, under the Fourth Amendment, a warrant is supposed to be signed by a judicial officer. In the state of Texas, what they've done, they've watered down the statute, whereas the deputy clerk is the one that issues the capias warrant, even as low as the warden for the fishing game can issue a capias warrant. So basically anybody can issue a capias warrant in Texas. But the good thing is that there's a case law of the appellate court from Texas that says if there's a conflict between the Constitution and the legislative body, the Constitution wins, and that's Towson versus State or Knoxville versus State. You can just say Fort Knox. It's easier to remember. But basically, this was a problem in Texas. Anybody and their neighbor could write a capias warrant, and the sheriffs would enforce it with no probable cause, no Fourth Amendment, and unless you challenge it. So that's a problem throughout Texas. And yes, Texas has some of the worst perpetrators of bar members. And to the fact is, one more quick thing, the Fifth Circuit last month have decided against the bar that the lawyers do not have to join the bar because the lawyers were complaining that the bar was corrupt. They're a political organization. They don't do anything for the law. And so the Fifth Circuit decided, well, if you're in Texas, you don't have to join the bar. Well, because it's a circuit court decision, the other circuits haven't weighed in on it. But I think if all the circuits weigh in on it, we could see the death of the bar coming slowly. So those are the items that we thought that were critical to our own Bill of Rights. But the issue with hiring an attorney where you lose your Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights because he didn't inform you, that to me goes to the heart of, you know, what the Republic gave us. Those three are our bread and butter. You know, fourth, you know, illegal search and seizure. Fifth, remain silent. And sixth, the right to effective counsel. I mean, you lose those three, you might as well lose the other eight. I mean, you know, your eighth, again, right to jury trial, out the door. I mean, you know, excessive fees, Eighth Amendment, goes out the door. To me, those are critical pieces not to lose as a citizen. So that's my, you know, that's my story, but you can check it out. The case Carlson v. Carlson out of Georgia, Townsend versus State out of Texas, and Knox versus State out of Texas. You can check out those case laws, and you'll be saying, why on earth anybody would retain a lawyer? Like, why on earth would you do it when you're worse off than if you walk in and says, Your Honor, I have no idea what the law is about?
Chris, for anybody that's on the line tonight, tell them where the real evil is in the child support system. So, a non-custodial parent that's wheeled into that system and gets an administrative law judge and they have to pay. How does the state make their money or the county make the money on that system? How have they got it set up? What is it with the federal government?
Yes, what the federal government is, which was real sneaky, the federal government signs a contract, a federal contract, with the Administration Association of Judges. So in other words, the judges in your state works directly with the federal government where they will directly reimburse them. And how they get away with it, they go to the governor of the state and gave him what is called an offer you can't refuse. If the governor's do not sign this contract, they will take the money and give it to other states. So if you're a governor and you see all this money coming in, and you're saying to yourself, I can either sign this contract or I'm basically walking away. So let's take an example. New Hampshire, which we have evidence of that. So New Hampshire Governor Sununu was given an offer last year. We will give you $800,000 over the next 4 years, 2020 to 2024, directly to the judges on one condition. You take all of this money, right, but we can run our international child support services through your state, and we will reimburse everyone in the state. So when you break down the budget, 35% of it goes to the sheriff, 23% goes directly to the judges, about another 14% goes to the clerks, and then the rest goes to the treasury of the state. Here's the issue. The governor doesn't have a choice. He either takes the money or he doesn't. And that, to me, is the biggest bribe ever, because you're thinking that you're before an impartial judge. No, you're not. You're before a bought and paid for federal judge.
In the state.
In the state. So you're never in a state court. You're in an international court, paid for by the federal government.
And also, you said $800,000 earlier. I thought the number was a little higher than that.
It was high overall, but I gave a number of, let's say they selected $800,000 over the next 4 years. Each state is different. They do it according to, you know, the per capita. But the point is, you get a specific budget. So it's a set amount each year over a five-year period.
So essentially what you're saying is, if the court system, the court administrators, which is where this money gets originated from, if the court administrators don't take the money or sell out our courts, our state courts, then they lose that money, and so it's kind of like the mob. It's an offer they made an offer that they cannot refuse.
It's free money, and it's an offer they cannot refuse. And they tell them, if this state doesn't take it, we will divide them among the other states. So you have no choice as a governor but to take it, because why wouldn't you take it? They're paying for all your clerks. They're paying for all your judges. You don't have to come out of the state budget for it. You don't have to come out of the treasury, and you don't have to balance your treasury books. So why wouldn't you take the money? You know, most of the treasuries for the states are all bankrupt, close to bankrupt, that is. They're just paper. So here comes the Fed money. You take it, and people get screwed.
And, Chris, why do you think our federal government will give up that much money to control our courts? They must be making something on the back end of this, right?
This all falls under trafficking of kids. It's all about the international law and the Hague Convention that was signed, and that's all this about. And someone mentioned it earlier, that's SDK Trust? Yes, it is a gold mine of all of this money. They're selling out on our trust. They're cashing in on those trusts. That's what they're doing. And that's why your kids are important.
And they
go ahead. If you want to control, if you want to control the population, control the children.
Yes, that's right. And then the parents.
Go ahead.
Well, I know it wasn't Mark Twain. Go ahead. Who said?
No, Hitler said that. Hitler said that when he went into Italy with Mussolini. You control the children, you control the population.
Right, and then as far as the parents themselves go, the way Chris and I look at this is there's keep it, they're dividing families and they're keeping them separated. Because in our experience, correct, once we get a non-custodial parent out of that system, then what happens is all of a sudden the other parent becomes much more agreeable because they still need money. And they,
correct,
can't survive on TANF. They can't survive on minimum assistance. So they become much more agreeable. And we're actually, Chris and I feel like we're bringing families back together. And that's
we are.
Why
that's
I joined
exactly
him in the
doing.
Struggle.
Yes. That's what we're doing. Because
that's
once we get the government out, yeah, when we once you get the government out of the middle, that's profiting off of this, again, 66 cents on the dollar, and the attorneys and the judges, what's left is the mother and father who has to sit down and how they're going to raise this child together. They don't have to be together, but they can raise it together. That's the whole issue. Because as long as I keep you apart, then I can profit. Right? The sheriff gets to profit from it, the clerks profit from it, everybody's profiting from it. So we're trying,
yeah,
to put
and the clerks are in on it. I think we should mention that too. The clerks are in. Go try to file something into a family court.
The clerks are the gatekeepers to the whole system. The clerks are, because the clerks are being paid 1/3 of the salary of the clerks are being paid by the state. The other 2/3 is paid by the federal government agency through this Title IV-D program. And we, like I said, we have the evidence for it, so we're not making up the numbers. We know what the numbers are. And that's what it is. But the issue of taking our justice system and basically throwing out to the highest bidder goes against the entire republic. And that is why there are no accountants in child support. There are no accountants in there, because if you put an accountant in there, he would discover the fraud in a very short period of time, and he would follow the trail probably to a private account somewhere offshore. That's why there are no accountants in the family court system.
Right, and there's no accountability either. I don't know where all this money is disappearing to, but it's definitely coming in. I just don't know where it's going.
Right, we know it's coming in. Yes.
Daniel, how are we doing on time, buddy?
Well, you went a little bit over, but I was sure hoping you were you had another specific topic that you missed. And
go ahead.
I know you brought Chris on, which is a treat and all that, but you were going to talk about the United States Treaty 9520. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. If I can just take a couple more minutes, I'll tell people about that. So,
we're
doing this deck. Go ahead.
We'll just take a few more minutes on that. It's okay. We're cutting the dates fine. He's forgivable.
Okay,
he can forgive.
It's well worth the time for people to understand this. So they call Congress the swamp for a reason, folks. And as we were working on this Declaration of Status and Fraud, we uncovered a treaty that was hidden from the American people, and it's a United Nations treaty that Congress entered into. They brought it to the legislation up in 1966, which is the year I was born, and I'm 55 years old. In 1978, they brought it to the House floor. And then it took 14 years for Congress to pass this treaty, and as soon as they passed it, they covered it up. But essentially, Treaty 95-20, which you can Google on the Congressional Record, and actually you don't have to Google it. If you get the Declaration of Status and Fraud, the administrative process, I put a copy, a complete copy of Treaty 95-20 in it. But what you want to do is you want to look at the Article 1 of that treaty, and that article says that all peoples have the right to self-determination. So these people that are trying to get out of the water jurisdiction and back onto the land and secure their rights as American nationals and doing all this paperwork, the reason they hid this treaty is because if all peoples have the right to self-determination, then I can walk into court with a copy of that treaty and say, hey, I'm a state citizen, I'm not a U.S. citizen, and I'm not a birthright citizen, so you don't have any authority over me, and here's a congressional treaty that proves it. And that's why they hid it. Congress took 14 years because they didn't want to pass it. I mean, at that time, back in 78, Tricky Dick took us off the gold standard in 71, in 77, the Treasury came out and said that the dollar has no assured value. And then in 78, the UN comes out with this treaty because they, if anybody can remember back that far, they were having a really hard time all over the world about trafficking. And today the trafficking is worse, but Congress didn't want to give up the gravy train by letting the people have the right to self-determination. And that goes back to your birth certificate, that goes back to your Social Security number. If you're a U.S. citizen, you're a debt slave. You're a debt slave to the corporate state. And that's why you don't have any rights in court, and that's why they treat you like you never had any rights in court. That's why everybody's afraid of the judges. Chris just told everybody that the judges are bought and paid for. And that's just what we know, folks. That's what we've uncovered. There's a lot of evil in our court system. Every court has a federal employee identification number. So am I in a federal jurisdiction or am I in a state jurisdiction? I don't know. But I can take a good guess. My contention is that the states aren't states. They're actually federal territories. And these courts that we think we're going into based on the state that's based on common law, they're nothing more than federal, regional, martial law rule tribunals. And you don't stand a chance. The only chance you stand is, like Chris said, don't go in there with a lawyer. But their advertising is so good that they make you believe that you don't have a chance if you go in there without a lawyer. And it's just the complete opposite. That's what Chris was saying tonight. It's just the complete opposite. You're much better off going in there not even knowing the law than you are going in there with a state bar attorney who takes a private oath that the system, meaning the state, comes first, their fellow brethren comes second, and their client comes a distant third. That's an oath that they take. They are there to protect the system, and the system is corporate government. You know, they hide it in plain sight. Like, how can you be the state of Georgia and be Georgia at one and the same time? If you think about it, that's impossible. You can't be something of something and be the something. It's a separate corporate entity. That's what state of means. I'm a corporation of Georgia. So, and every time you get prosecuted, especially in a criminal trial, you always get prosecuted in the name of the state of Georgia whenever they have a prosecutor. You're getting prosecuted by a corporation. So, with that, I shared Treaty 9520. I put it all together. I put the congressional record together. And for anybody that wants to get that, Daniel has that in the Declaration of Status and Fraud. But if you want to open your eyes up to the corruption, just ask Daniel for a copy of that declaration. And plus, it gives you an administrative process that they won't answer. And that's always been our secret. That's Chris and I's secret. We file paperwork that they can't answer without exposing the fraud. So if you don't know anything about the law, you file this into your case. If you have an open case, you wait 20 days, 21 days, and you send a notice of default and opportunity to cure. You wait 21 more days, you send them a final default, and then send the court a true bill or the agency or whoever it is in corporate government that's bothering you. I don't care if it's the meter maid, you know, downtown. Any agency of the government, any of those three-letter agencies, and that's what Glenn was touching on earlier before I came on. The bar grievance can be used many different ways. I've actually seen that grievance, and it's a good grievance. And with that, I will yield. I enjoyed talking to everybody tonight.
Thank you so much, Ed. That's kind of unusual for you to have to be put in a time restraint, but you did real good. And
thank you.
We're having our last speaker of the night's having a hard time getting on, so I'm gonna see what's going on with that. I hope that she gets on. She's trying. Bonnie, have you gotten on? Dave's gonna go before you, but I just want to make sure. Are you here?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good, good, good. Okay, you did get on. Beautiful. There's a number that we use. Some people can't get on using the free conference call number, and there's a number that one of our House of Prayer members, listeners, sent in that you can call in and actually access. And so that worked for Dave. Dave, you're next before Bonnie. And then we'll wrap it up with Bonnie. And I'm excited about tonight. We're just a little bit over. Dave, are you there? You're muted out. We can't hear you. I wonder what happened to Dave.
Well, can Bonnie go, and then we'll come back to Dave.
Well, we could do that. We could do that.
Well,
yeah,
I'm just what Bonnie's got to say.
Yeah.
Is Dave,
she wanted to be last.
I did. Actually, I had to break from sitting down and having a fellowship meal with a bunch of the other patriots that we had planned, and it kind of is. I've got them in the restaurant eating, and I'm sitting out in the car. So
yeah.
It'd be
no,
great
no.
If the other
Bonnie, just give me a second here. Just everybody, take just a second. I'm going to find out what happened. I wonder if you got kicked or not. I'll just go ahead and find out.
Okay.
All right, yeah, Dave is, he said he could hear everybody fine, but for some reason they couldn't hear him, so he's on his way here, Bonnie, so you'll be able to do your thing. It's been a good night. You know, while I'm at this, Ed's, while we're waiting for Dave to come back on, you said the word true bill two or three times. Could you tell everybody what your definition of a true bill is that you're talking about at the end of your administrative process? Explain it, describe it, and do you have a copy of such a thing that we can include when I do the mail out so everybody gets a copy of all these documents? I can include this thing.
There's two files that I sent you and John and a couple of other people. Dave's got a copy of it, but there's two files. The first file is the 62-page declaration of fraud with the timeline in it that they can't answer. So then we send the notice of opportunity, and then I send a Word copy of the true bill where you can fill in your own numbers. But a true bill, the best way to explain it where people understand it without getting inundated is whenever you get a credit card statement or any kind of statement, you get a bill from the utility company, they've always got this little perforated thing at the bottom. But the problem is it's a statement. It's not a true bill. In other words, what I'm saying when I issue a true bill is I'm saying this is how much that you owe me. This is not a statement. This is what you owe me. This is the true bill. So you need to pay the true bill, and I can take a true bill into any court of law, and I can get a default judgment on it. You know, all I got to do is prove that I never got answered. Tacit acquiescence, that's a word everybody needs to understand. Tacit acquiescence, when they don't respond, they're submitting to it. A declaration, an unrebutted affidavit stands as truth in commerce. That's the sixth maximum of law. An unrebutted affidavit stands as truth in commerce. So when they don't answer, then they're submitting to basically your jurisdiction. And so then the true bill is what they get from you for taking your time and your energy up having to deal with them. That's what they owe you. So the true bill is what you want to it's in the package that I sent with the administrative process for the declaration of status in fraud. And also
yes,
a complete copy of the Congressional 9520.
Yes, it is. And I will be sending it out to everybody. I just wanted that to be explained on the record since we had a little bit of time while we're waiting for Dave to get back on. But now he's back on, so Dave, it is your time. I think you got like 3 minutes. Can you do it in three? I'm joking, Dave.
Real hard. Hey guys,
you're on, brother.
Sorry about that. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can finally hear you.
Can you? All right, good. All right. Well, I don't know. I'll let everybody know now on the call. This past Sunday, I was heading down to fill up my tank, and a sneaky cop went by me and around the corner and parked so that I'd pass by him. And he flipped on his lights and pulled me over. I pulled off onto a side road, dirt road. Don't want to be on the highway. But he pulled me over. His probable cause, it says, it's funny here, it says PC on the ticket. fictitious plates. Now, I haven't been pulled over in 7 years, and the last time I was pulled over, my license plate was a private property, no trespassing sign. the tag I have on my car now, I created for my trust, and I drove to Vegas, past hundreds of cops, back and forth from Montana, back and forth with this vehicle, with these plates. Had no issues, and I get pulled over a half a mile from where I'm staying. Anyway, the guy pulls me over. I do what I would normally do if I come in contact with an agent, which I have a memorandum, 25-page memorandum of law written by Jeff Sessions in 2017 on the on religious freedom and the state's burden to accommodate my religious beliefs. I also give a judicial notice of private trust affidavit, which explains, you know, about me, my property, who I am, who I'm not. Told the guy, I said, don't misconstrue this on his recorder. Don't misconstrue this name with any legal person. Told him that the property was not the property of the state of Montana, that it was property of my private trust. Told him that the state of Montana does not have subject matter jurisdiction over my private affairs or my private property. Basically, he didn't get the point. Didn't read the document through, obviously. but he did have a little fear in his eyes, and he was a little intimidated, so he called out for help, like they always do. And a few minutes later, Fed shows up, and he says, basically, you know, he was in the area, you know, there's a federal wildlife preserve right over the hill. So he showed up, which I thought was real interesting and is going to play very well into this process that I'm going to go through here. I've been waiting for an opening, and this one opened it up both in the state and in the federal courts for declaratory judgment actions eventually. In the meantime, I decided to add a declaration to my process and notice of prosecutorial burden, and I'll get into the both of them in a minute. But the tickets, it's funny, a couple minutes I get the Fed shows up. I was talking to him for almost a whole hour while the other guy was sitting in his car trying to figure out for 25, 30 minutes who I was. He says, I couldn't find you anywhere. I said, well, that's because I haven't had a contract with any state since 2008. And that was when the last one expired. And I told him I was Google proof. Anyway, he called and two other sheriff deputies came out. One was like 12 years old. And the other guy looked like a military guy. You know, he was the only one that was not smiling. And he was taking pictures of my license plate. I said, you're taking that for your scrapbook? He goes, no, that's for the case file. Oh, I said, great. You know, that's going to help me a lot. Because that is actual evidence of all the documentation, including the title, which is in the name of my trust, was purchased in the name of my trust. And the title also shows that I'm the trustee over that property, over that trust that purchased it. I also, excuse me, my puppy's getting rambunctious here. When I buy something, I do it in the name of my trust. I use a private contract bill of sale. A bill is a law between the parties. Once it's considered and signed, it is the law between the parties. So this private contract bill of sale for the property that I got pulled over in is owned, it says here, is to the buyer, Kingdom of Heaven Trust. Seller hereby represents and warrants the buyer that the seller is the absolute owner of said property, that said property is free and clear of all liens, charges, and encumbrances, and that the seller has full right, power, and authority to sell said personal property and make this bill of sale. parties to the sale are private and are the only parties to this conveyance contract. The signatures below are evidence of the intentions of the parties to transfer ownership from the seller to the buyer. He signed it. The buyer was the Kingdom of Heaven Trust by me, trustee. So I've got two pieces of evidence that show that I have subject matter jurisdiction over the vehicle in the first place. So this guy's already behind the eight ball, and I told him straight up that, his best bet would not to be bringing the actions against me. But you go ahead and do what you want. You know, I'm not going to argue with you on the side of the road with, you know, your gang of buddies here. So he wrote the tickets, and what I'm going to do, or what I'm doing now, I did create a declaration of status, capacity, legal relationships, and rights. Now, when we do a declaratory judgment action, that's what we're looking for. We want our rights declared, our legal relationships, our capacity. What is our status? What are our rights? What interests do we have in the subject matter? Okay? Very much like a quiet title action. I'm saying I have the highest claim. Now, I can go and do a declaratory judgment action, but I don't want a judge to decide what my rights are. So I decided to add this declaration, basically. And if you don't know me, I don't operate in the water, you know, in maritime jurisdiction. I don't operate in the land jurisdiction. I operate under the air, H-E-I-R, jurisdiction. Yeah. So, ecclesiastical jurisdiction, okay? So my declaration doesn't use all of the codes and statutes and, you know, constitutions and things like that. I literally do everything utilizing my indenture, which is the Bible. That is the indenture of my trust. And it's a private trust between myself and the Creator. And that's what this declaration states. The Bible says that I am a citizen of heaven. Well, that's declared. So I'm declaring in this declaration. It's about 7 pages. I wanted to have it ready for tonight, but I did want to stick in one of my witnesses is the Word of God itself. So I'm putting composing a bunch of scripture to add at the bottom that my declaration stands on. Okay? I'm also going to be adding to it a list of definitions of words like reconcile. Okay? The Bible says that I'm an ambassador, okay, to reconcile all things to God. Okay? Reconcile is a really interesting word. Kind of like it. When, give me one second, I'll pull it back up because I had it sitting there. All right. Reconcile is to restore to harmony.
Yeah, I can't get on. My phone won't call.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, David. Somebody just didn't have their phone muted out. I muted them. Go ahead.
No problem. Okay, so to reconcile something is to restore to harmony. Okay? Interesting that concile is... it is a group. I'm going to have to actually. I'll go back and do that one next. Concile, but it reconcile is to restore to harmony, reconcile the parties, to bring resolution to differences, to account for, to become reconciled, and a lot of times you'll hear that when it comes down to relationship terms. Okay, it's a relationship term. Okay, all trusts are relationships, all relationships are trusts. If there is no trust, there's no relationship, and I say that all the time. But in this case, it says here, and it's a lot of times you'll hear to reconcile in the terms of spouses prior to getting divorced. They reconcile their differences, and sometimes there's irreconcilable differences. I kind of have those with the state, and this is why this was a perfect opportunity to go in and literally go take. I have a feeling they're going to look at what I'm going to submit to them in the beginning anyway. My declaration, the judicial notice of private trust affidavit that has to be responded to, memorandum of law on religious freedom, notice of jurisdictional inquiry with questions that need to be answered. I'm going to be sending in the notice of prosecutorial burden to the prosecutor and to the judge so that they know what to look for. And those are just the beginning of what I'm sending back. I find it funny, just as a sidebar, that I'm looking at this ticket. And you know, if you ever gotten a ticket, there's lots of little boxes, each one separate. Oh, and by the way, they did put in the legal person name, which I am obviously not, and can easily explain that one away. But everywhere it says something of what you would think is important. It's in all capital letters. And all capital letters, to me, I write using all capital letters, and I use them when I'm talking about something that is a fiction, okay, a legal fiction. So in all capital letters, it says the defendant is hereby given notice to contact Justice Court within 30 days to schedule an appointment to appear in court. The cop circled that, and then he put stars and said 10 days. So stop at that. I don't know if that would mean anything. But, again, there's all kinds of things here that, you know, legalese gobbledygook that I don't pay much attention to anyway. My paperwork all goes to the challenge of jurisdiction. And with this declaration and the other things that I am putting in, I'm firmly establishing under what jurisdiction I reside. Okay? And there's so much so, and because it's a declaration, it needs to be overcome. Okay? They can't just go, oh, you know, that's frivolous, like what John was saying earlier. Okay? This is my declaration. I get to decide who I am, who I'm going to serve, what, you know, whether or not I'm going to take something into trust or extend something in trust. You know, I have the right to, you know, a free association. And I also have the right not to associate. So there's a lot of questions that come up that are ripe for for a declaratory judgment action. And they, as far as I'm concerned, they all pertain to authority and jurisdiction over me and my, you know, affairs, things that have been entrusted to me. So one of the things I put in the declaratory judgment is that, you know, this declaration is not up for judicial, executive, or legislative, you know, debate, and that, you know, if they want to, you know, if they want to challenge it, then reply as if they would, you know, any other applicant. So, anyway, I'll be getting these documents done and in on Monday. I plan on, I have a feeling they're not going to prosecute this one. I think they're just going to throw it out. But because when I get pulled over and I get having contacts with cops, I do end up being called, you know, the old standby oxymoron sovereign citizen. You know, they will assume that that's what I am or presume me to be one. They even, two out of the four cops asked me. And, you know, I basically asked them back. I mean, can you define a sovereign citizen? What is a sovereign citizen? How are you going to, you know, to me it sounds like an oxymoron. And that's really, that's actually what I said. I said, are you an oxymoron? Is what I told him. I said, can you define that for me? You know, that's a domestic terrorist if anybody's wondering. But when you have them putting that in their statements, okay, and it goes into the public record, it's on the public record that you are a. Now, he wasn't stupid enough to do that here, although this was just a ticket. There was no space for his statement, which I'm sure would be sitting in the prosecutor's office.
once they assign this case to somebody, if they assign this case to somebody. I'm sure there'll be a prosecutor to look at it. But, as far as that goes, there's very little chance that they're going to prosecute. But whether they do or not won't make a difference. I'm not worried about the case. I've already beat them in this state three other times for the same thing. They failed to prosecute me for the same exact trifecta of garbage. But as far as the declaratory judgment action, we had two different jurisdictions show up, county sheriffs, three of them, and a federal fish and game law enforcement officer. So I get to do this in both jurisdictions and have my rights declared once and for all, and I'm going to require a memorandum to go out to all these agents. And I'm going to use my win in my declaratory judgment to go and collapse these trusts that are set up in the public in that legal fiction name. I am out to kill my straw man, and that is what I'm going to do, and I won't be happy till there's a death certificate and all of those trusts and assumed and implied contracts are no more. So hopefully you guys will follow along as the fun, as the fun starts here. I will keep everybody aware on this call. I will be giving Daniel all the documents that I'll be sending in. I will also have all responses. This way you could see how things are working firsthand in a live case that I get to go play with these folks here and the little kittens in the lions then. And unlike others, I like to go in and deal with things face-to-face. So I'll be bringing in serving the court and the judge and the prosecutor, if they already have one, the cops. And I'll be doing that probably on Monday. So keep in touch, keep coming to the calls. And again, I'm going to hand over the docs and things that I submit and any responses that come back to my paperwork, or whether they no prosecute my case, which they may just call up to Missoula, because that's usually where I've dealt with them in the past. And up there, they do not, if they pull me over, they were told to leave me alone. Just let them go. We don't want them in our court. We don't want them in our jail. It costs us too much. So they don't bother me up in Missoula, the next county up. I've never had an issue in this county in the 5 years that I've been driving around here. So, like I said, this is going to be fun. In order to do a declaratory judgment action, there has to be some controversy. It can't be something that's made up. Okay, so here we have a legitimate controversy that would continue to persist, regardless if I win this ticket or not. There's a much bigger issue. And that's the issue I'm going to deal with. And I want to deal with it in a way that's final. I really don't care whether or not I have a driver's license or a passport from them. I'm sure I can still get a passport regardless. But at the same time, these contracts and a Social Security account and contracts with the government, it is my firm belief that it is that commerce, the admiralty system that they masquerade in, is mammon, okay? And that is Babylonian slavery, free-range slavery, where they control you by being a debtor. And that's what happens. They look at you as the debtor. They're not looking at you as the creditor. And I'm not one for commercial remedy either, even though I've studied all this stuff for over 30 years. I've come to the conclusion that all of their stuff is nothing more than, the addition or subtraction from God's law, and it's nothing more than a bunch of legalese babble, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't like to use it anymore. I've tried that. I've when Ed was talking about, or excuse me, when John was talking about frivolous, I've had two cases in the federal court here in Montana that were refused for being frivolous. And there wasn't ever a response, just that my case was frivolous. The judge decided before, and I paid for it. They're not supposed to do that. But they do. They're criminals. So that's why I don't care. I don't want to argue with them. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to enter that jurisdiction and start arguing. I am going to go in there and shut it down. And that's what I've done in the past, and that's what I get to do now, and take it a step further and do the declaratory judgments both in the state of Montana as well as federal. In this way, it's done. My rights will be declared as per my declaration, because they're never going to respond to the declaratory judgment action that we put in anyway. So, but it should be a fun time, and it'll be definitely good information for those that are looking for a way to be free from the system. And again, all the documents Daniel should have by the next call for sure. So I'll leave it with that, Daniel. Thank you for letting me share.
Yes, Dave, but there's one thing I need you to do before we let you off the hook. Surprisingly, and I know you pretty well now, we've been working together for, I don't know how long it's been, but it's been a pretty good long time for me to realize that you've made three very specific verbal errors here that I'd like you to correct. I heard you call this man a judge. Would you do me a favor and correct the record on who he really is?
Yeah, he's the schmuck sitting in my father's seat.
Thank you, Dave. He's the imposter sitting in your father's seat. I just had to have you correct the record for all of us. So now what I'm going to do is... Again?
No, he's a fraud sitting in my father's seat.
Thank you. All right, so what I'm going to do now, Dave, that you've demonstrated it, I don't know if Bonnie made it on, so let's try first. Are you there, Bonnie? She may be here in 5 minutes, according to the text she gave me. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to open up the floor early until before Bonnie comes on for question and answer and see if there's any other questions out there. So I'm going to unmute some of the people I muted. Go ahead. Is this Harold?
Yes.
Comments are welcome, too, by the way, Harold.
What's that again, sir?
Comments are also welcome.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was going to do, some comment. I start with you because I got like 3 pages of notes, so I'm just going to skim. I can see why you were excited about my explanatory statement, because in your statement, you incorporated almost everything that I did, and especially regarding the calling an election. I made that very, very loud and clear in that document. I hope you shared it with the people. With Glenn, with the bar grievance, unless I missed it, because I did step away a couple times, one of the things about the bar grievance that makes them so powerful, not so much as the outcome, because normally they deny most of them, but that it's a hit on their bond or their insurance. And that's what really, really hurts them. If they get about between 3 or 5, their bonding could be dropped. So that hurts them in the pockets. Like I've stated before over and over again over the years, it's only 2 things this system recognizes, and that's force and money. We don't have the power to use force, but we can go after the pockets. So that's what makes that very effective. And people should also try to get the bond or insurance information of the attorney. Some bar associations will give it to you. A lot of them will not. But it should be a matter of public records, because they're actually public officers. So it's not really a secret. Okay. Getting to Ed, I love that they use the term constitutional protection, because many people in this sphere often call them constitutional rights, which they're not. They're actually protections, a barrier between the people and the government. Now, what Chris has said about getting an attorney and waiving certain rights on appeal. Now, for the most part, I would say 98% was good. But there is ways, which I've done personally myself, so I know it's been done, where you can say, for instance, that particular person got railroaded by the attorneys, as most people do, and you lose and you try to appeal and you can't get through, just like Chris said, and that's accurate. But what you can do is go back down, or even before going up to appeal, and I've done this with people in criminal cases, is to create a record below before going on the appeal and consolidate both and go on appeal. And the one going down attacking the judgment, you move to vacate it under ineffective assistance of counsel, which is a very hard claim to win, but at least you can get a solid record before going up on appeal. But in the general sense, yes. Except an attorney, you essentially waive all your rights because you give them to the attorney, and he executes them according to his wishes. You're basically an invalid, an idiot in the court that can't do anything except fire the attorney. So you basically lose everything. So that point was well taken. And the quote by the controlling the child, you can control the nation or something like that, he mentioned, he attributed to Hitler, but actually it came from Ignatius of Loyola, perhaps the first Jesuit. The 9520, that's an interesting document, and particularly how United States signed on to the treaty. I did a declaration of status with someone back in 2017, and which I incorporated that in there. Now, the technology that they use is that when the United States declared that the provisions of Article 1 through 27 of the covenant are not self-executing. So not only hiding it, they also making it not self-executing, meaning if you do not invoke it, it doesn't even exist. So in using 9520, you want to invoke it. Otherwise, it's not there. So they were really, really slick with that. And 9520 is actually that whole covenant. What do they call it? The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. That's the actual name of it under the UN Charter. It's a tricky document because it's actually protections for men and women and legal persons combined in the document. So you really, really have to know what you're reading to extrapolate what applies to men and women and what applies to legal persons. But what Ed had brought out, that particular provision he was speaking of pertains to men and women, not legal persons. So that's another thing about that document. And lastly, with Dave, he might want to get in a notice of the status without, you know, giving a nexus with the court, which would bring you under their jurisdiction. The notice doesn't do that. So you want to avoid the nexus, and you want to get it in before any appearance. And he seems to have everything else under control. So that's my overview. I have a lot more here, but I just want to make it short. What's that again, sir?
There's three. There's three notices.
Great, great. Yeah, you want to use notices. Not so much, unless you use an affidavit, a notice affidavit. But I generally use notices, and that keeps the nexus disconnected, yet you get your message across. And then if you go in, you just rely on the record. You don't even have to speak to anything but within the record. That way you don't have to argue. Once you argue, you're in their jurisdiction anyway. You don't want to argue. Just like you say, you don't even want to be in their jurisdiction. So that's it on my overview. I have a lot more here, but I don't want to take up too much time.
Oh, no, Harold, you did good. We really appreciate you sharing. What I'm going to do right now is open up and unmute those that were pesky noise in the background and or I heard some noise and maybe didn't realize that they were not muted. And I'm going to unmute you so you can ask questions and answers. Does anybody have a question while I'm doing that for any of the special speakers or in general or comments like Harold did that they feel compelled to share?
Yeah, me, I just wanted to actually find out how can I get the email address.
Say this again. You were breaking up. Let's try that one more time.
I want to see how can I get the email address so we can get those documents.
Oh, have you not received an email from Constant Contact for the House of Prayer?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, give me your email address, and I will. I tell you what, I'll give you my email address. You send me a response. I'll make sure that you're on because I'm going to be asking John if he has a Word doc on the frivolous word study, because I'd like everyone to actually see that, because that went by like a speeding freight train for me, and I tried to stay along, you know, you hear information, so he'll have the cases, he might have a Word doc for us. We will have at least a link to Glenn's bar grievance, if not an example that I'll put in the mailing. We'll have the client-attorney agreement, and I love that, he basically streamlined the bar letter that I've been using for years for people to bar the bar, and it's just really streamlined, and I love that. And that's from Ed, and then the declaration, and the
actually John, that's from John.
Which one? The client attorney agreement.
Yeah, John and I worked on that together. It took us 2 days, and we got it down to one paragraph. Remember, mine was a conditional acceptance of counsel, but it was 24 pages. So I'm still using a conditional acceptance of counsel. I'm just adding a client attorney agreement and tell them they have to sign it if they plan on representing me. So
I love that.
It works. It either way, I mean, the client attorney agreement, the fact that they won't sign it, and that you can expose the fraud of the bar before you even get into court.
That is
because, go ahead.
No, I was going to quickly say that in my experience, I've been in this over almost 35 years now, and I had something similar, but I love yours, that paragraph that you read. It makes it much more condensed.
Right.
I never had one to sign. None of them ever signed it.
Right, and
we've got a girl that we've been working with, a law student that started asking her professors questions, and you know, she was top of her class. Some of the people know who I'm talking about right now. She served 95 attorneys in her county and the state bar, and told them money was no object. I'll pay you any amount you want. I just need representation. She couldn't get not one. She said a couple of the attorneys actually called and cussed her out. That's how devastating that agreement is. They won't sign it. And whenever you get something like that, you're on the right track.
Hey, Daniel. And what makes that so powerful is that if you don't get your, especially in a criminal case, if you don't get your Sixth Amendment right, the process can't go forward. So I saw cases stalled on that point alone.
And
what
I stalled you myself.
This is John, and we've stalled them before like that. Just we'll go out and these attorneys won't agree to sign anything, we show back up to court and so tell the judge, so yeah, we just can't get one. And we actually we subpoenaed two attorneys in one time. Nobody agreed to come to court, so the judge said if we didn't have somebody there, it was going to be bad. So we just subpoenaed two attorneys. it was hysterical. But anyway, the case went away. It was just a minor traffic case, but it sure did ruffle everybody's feathers when we subpoenaed those attorneys in there to show up because we couldn't find any.
Well, I love it when I can't get a word in edgewise on my own call. I've been trying to tell you this three times now. This is a great call, by the way. You gentlemen, I'm humbled to be around your presence. I think we've got collectively on this call probably 300 to 500 years of experience in amongst the people in this call tonight. And we still have one speaker left. She'll be here soon. And I believe that's going to be a piece of icing on the cake for us. But I just wanted to tell you that when I did my bar-to-bar letter process, I actually wanted to go right to the top. I went to the Bar Association webpage for the two states near me, Missouri and Arkansas, and they just left some low-hanging fruit out for me. They said, if you need an attorney, you can just go ahead and ask us, and we'll recommend an attorney. So I sent my list of recommendations of what I needed in an attorney, and they sent me back a rejection. No such attorney exists. And they sent me my money back. So I got that in writing from the president of the Bar Association of Missouri and Arkansas. And dang it, if you wouldn't believe, they took that provision down offline. It's no longer available to get recommendations online. I don't know why they did that.
Hey,
Daniel,
hello?
This is Kirkland. Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Yeah, Daniel, did you ever get a copy of the Bill of Rights' trickery invoked for the clientele letter for that universal one that we designed for the public? Did you ever get that from me?
I doesn't sound familiar, but if you want to send it out to the group and be able to disseminate it to the House of Prayer call, I would be happy to share it with the crowd. If you think
yeah,
it has
I'll
value, Kirkland.
I can send you the updated one that we designed that works for us. And
what
and
is it called
money
again?
Back from an attorney. And it's designed for several. It's designed for the judge, the attorney, the police officer, even on the side of the road when you get pulled over. And it's short and sweet. It's like maybe, I don't know, a few pages. It's basically a trickery document designed just to let them touch it, briefly look at it. They won't even look at it. They'll hand it back to you, even the judge or the lawyers. And then what you do is you take that document, you fill it out, and you check the box, and then use it for Exhibit A for when you go for evidence and submit it as evidence, and then, boom, you got them. So it's really that simple. But anyways, I'll send that to you so you can share it. It sounds like some of these guys on the panel are on the same page with that client thing of contract. Basically, it's a contract between I switch it to the plaintiff with the attorney that's appointed to them because they won't accept you as the plaintiff. They always want you to be the defendant, but you got to flip it around and become the plaintiff, and they become the defendants, and you object to whatever their reason of subject matter that they believe, and you create a conflict of interest, and you bring up all the wrongdoing of the judge's wrongdoing, the police officer's wrongdoing, and the attorney's wrongdoing, and you put it on the record, and you get it on the record no matter what, and that's gonna shut it all down real quicker than you think. But anyways, that's from the Bill of Rights office, and I just wanted to share that with you guys, okay?
Thank you, Kirkland. Thank you for being with us. I will share that. I put it on my list. It's called the you're calling the Bill of Rights letter?
No, it's a trickery contract. It's basically just called the trickery contract, invoking your rights to the judge, the lawyer, and the police officer. You're tricking him, and you're trapping them. You're basically throwing a rope out, and then your rope's been put on their neck, and then they slowly tighten it.
All right. I'll include it with the mailing with everyone else's documents. This is what we do here.
Right,
we come to learn.
Hey, that panel,
yep.
You guys are great. There's a lot of things I do a little differently, but you know what? We all uniting together, and we all help each other out. And our mission should really expose these guys and go after them for a couple of main points. Operating under the color of law, high treason, and conflicting laws. At everything that I heard tonight, if you focus on those issues that I just point out to you, you're going to come a long ways, and you're going to come out on top. Okay? Thanks.
Hey,
I want to quickly follow up on something that Kirkland was talking about. The reason we designed the client-attorney agreement and the reason it was so important to us, and we all have something a little bit different, you know, whether you call it a bar-to-bar letter or a trickery statement, but the client-attorney agreement, the reason it's so powerful is because, especially in criminal matters, you it's a Sixth Amendment right to have effective assistance of counsel. And if you can't get the counsel, they can't have a case. And if they go ahead and try to force you into a bench trial, which they do a lot, without effect. So when you go to court, you never waive your right to effective assistance of counsel. And if you serve that agreement and no attorney will sign it, they can't assign a public defender because they're not going to sign it either. So if you can't get counsel, you can't be tried because they only allow state bar attorneys to practice at the bar. So
that goes to Zerps versus Johnson.
That's right.
Zerps versus Johnson. It's a jurisdictional issue. You're absolutely correct.
Can you repeat the case? Can you repeat the case, Harold?
Zerps, Z-E-R, I think is B-T versus Johnson. I'll send you a Westlaw copy of it, Daniel.
Artersinger versus Hamlin and Johnson versus Zerps are the two cases.
Yeah. It's jurisdictional in nature.
Yes. I want to let you all know that these recordings, hold on a second, I got an announcement so I don't forget because I forgot up to this point. I don't know who that is, but holding the wings. That the webpage, myhouseshallbecalled.com, which is on the bottom of your mailing, has been upgraded, and our recordings now, there's a recording player, a very generous and wonderful man is on these calls tonight, has helped the webpage actually be updated. It hasn't been updated in 4 years with an audio player, and these calls, you'll be able to send your friends and loved ones to these calls, and they'll be placed right on the webpage for easy access. So that's a really good upgrade. So keep in mind that webpage. If you're taking notes, it's myhouseshallbecalled.com. And if you go there now, the recording for Joan Priestley is on there, and she's the one that did the COVID nonsense call about 3 weeks ago when she had, you know, the call where she had worked with those same players in her practice in previous years in her life and exposed that they're the same players in this COVID scandemic as well. If you haven't heard that call, it is on the webpage. You go there and click on the player and you can listen to the recording. So that's a really exciting development for this Ministry of Health. And there I'll also be able to deposit documents at the freedom of the parties that created them for people that want to do them themselves and do documents themselves. And, of course, I always recommend that you find somebody that's a mentor, do your diligence, because it's not just throwing words. You want to have a legal effect. And when you start having a legal effect, things get exciting. When you don't have a legal effect and you're just throwing words at it, you get discouraged quickly. And we need you in this. We need you in this battle. We don't need you to be losing. We need you to be winning. I'm sorry. Now, who was getting ready to speak when I was interrupted them?
Yeah, it's Kirkland again. I just got three points that I want. I'd like to make 3 points before closure for everybody that I think is very important. Number one, I believe you should focus on high treason, have two witnesses during due process violations, and charge them for Title 18, 2183, high treason, treason by sedition, breaking down the walls. You'll get them real good on that. And the other thing is, the most important thing of all I've learned in my studies for the past years from my favorite teacher, Carl Miller, is the Supremacy Clause. If you read actually Article 6, Paragraph 2, the last seven words is the most important words. And I actually shared this with some attorneys that are part of the bar, and they switched and they changed their whole program. is the last seven words. Now, I could paraphrase it for you, but I'm not going to get there. But basically, the key word is notwithstanding in law. So I just want to leave that point with you. And Daniel, I think you might know about that because we discussed it before. But if anybody has any questions and need me to elaborate on it later, contact me, and I'll help and assist. Okay?
Thank you with that. All right. Is Bonnie, are you on here yet?
And can I get your email address?
Kirkland, did you want to give your email address out online?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. Everybody around the nation already got it. All the attorneys across the nation got it. Yes. It's OfficerKirkland@iCloud.com.
How do you spell Kirkland, please?
It's K-I-R-K-L-A-N-D. It's Captain Kirk with land behind it, but I ain't got no land.
Officer Kirkland at cloud.com?
Yeah, Officer Kirkland at iCloud.com.
Oh, iCloud. Thank you.
And Daniel has the HQ office headquarters phone number and the Montana phone number. Okay?
Thank you.
One other thing, Daniel, real quick, I'd like for you to touch bases on a topic later. I don't know if I pronounce it right or not, but maybe everybody might know what I'm talking about because they've been doing this for so long. But it's called, I've learned from Carl Miller, it's called a quorantal, where you dissolve an institution that's operating under the color of law, like a small town, city, or county. And Carl Miller talks about it quite a bit in his teachings. And I was wondering that if you can maybe have a topic on that one of these days, because our offices are actually dissolving institutions and file paperwork across the nation as we speak. And we're really into that. Actually, Missoula, Montana, has one been filed against Judge Bill. I'm still going after Reardon again because I've battled with Reardon down in Hamilton. And I also got rid of Langton. He retired early.
That's exactly where I'm dealing is Hamilton.
Okay. Yeah, I would definitely think about the quoranto where you dissolve the institution that whatever's giving you the problem, even if it goes right down to the sheriff's department or if it goes down to a police department or whatever. But anyways, I wish I would have been – I will leave it at that because I know you guys – I got so much to share, but I better stop, okay?
Kirkland, do you live around here in Montana?
I travel the states. My HQ is in Arkansas. I have a home in Montana, but I'm basically traveling the states on so many cases because the National Assembly and National Alliance has sent me so many contacts. Our offices are just totally just swamped constantly. But I'll tell you what my main objective is. What I wanted to tell you, Daniel, and say again?
This is the next time you're up in Montana.
Yeah, we can still elaborate and contact, and I'll help you. Because I've been after those guys for a long time, and I got rid of a few of them. But what I wanted to let you know where the problem is that I think the panel should kind of focus on, too, if they can, is illegal warrants. Our office created emergency injunction for illegal warrants that are not properly formatted, and they're arresting and putting people in jail for traffic infractions. So we're making a big issue about that on our documents that we designed for that, me and my number one Florida office. So I'd like to share that with you, Daniel, and the panel, too. So you're going to love that because if you file that and send that up, and somebody's got a warrant, an illegal warrant, man, it just tears them up. I mean, it's great. So,
well, I'd like to see that, Kirkland. I've got it on my list. I just want everybody to know, be patient with me. It might take us a few days for everybody to get all the documents together, but for sure, the middle Thursday between now and our next call, which is September 2nd, you will get a copy of all these documents spoken on from the House of Prayer. So be patient with me. You don't have to send me an email and remind me. All the people that have given me your email and receiving our emails will get these documents.
Okay, Daniel, one more thing before I let you guys go. I'm sorry for taking up the time here. I wanted to let people know that the Bill of Rights Office across the United States, we focus on basically using the Constitution as a weapon, basically the sister states in harmony, and that's all we do, and we're like 98% successful. We're not really into the lawsuits stuff just yet because we're not really studying that. All we're doing is we try to shut them down, expose them, plant the evidence and the seeds of the evidence for people that can sue them is what we do. And that's how we operate. But I want to stress this because tonight I heard about this national stuff and the citizens and all this. I just want to say this to people. Deep down, if you study amateur prudence of law, Shepard citation, 200 case laws way back 200 years or plus, you will find, you pull the construction fraud back, there's only a true distinct difference between an American citizen and a national citizen. So when you hear all the stuff about Enavon stuff and a straw man and all that, that's a national citizen, period. I don't care what anybody says, I'll argue with you all day long, that's a national citizen, and you don't want to go there, and I don't recommend going there. I would recommend staying as an American citizen where you actually have a free agency to choose between your free agency to choose between the Constitution and the science fiction side or the fictional side. I'll leave it at that.
Daniel, can I please interject for one moment? This is my first time being on your call, this amazing group, a collection of amazing group, and I was referred through Glenn. And I wanted to know if I can just give you my email and if I can be included on your contact list.
Yes, if you don't want to give your email over the air, I'm going to tell you, just send an email, anybody that's on this call, send an email to iamdanieljoseph@protonmail.com. I'll put you on the email list, and you will be included in the future mailings. My recommendation to you, if you think this is valuable, you need to send me 10 or 15 people. This is not a commerce. We don't sell the mailing list. We're just trying to get the word out. These gentlemen on these calls here that I have surrounded myself with, these are and women, these are the most brilliant people I know of. That's why they're here. And so I try to make this available, but it's a shame that it only goes out to under 100 people right now. I know that I don't know what happens once it gets out there, and it can, you know, it can be like to this party and that party, and then start to multiply. But I'd love to see everybody on this call go ahead and send me parties that you love and care for that need to hear this information so we can broaden our spectrum. That makes me happy and makes me feel effective. Now, tonight we had about 60 people on the call, and it's a good call. We're down now. People got tired, and we're down now. But we had a very big call tonight comparatively to 45 or 50, or 45 or 40 even. So I am Daniel Joseph at protonmail.com. I started this call here from our Fayetteville House of Prayer office here near Fayetteville, Arkansas, where I happen to habitate. And we moved it out and branched out to the House of Prayer call because we got tired of just having all these nuggets in our little group. We wanted to share it with the world. So Ministry of Health.
Fantastic.
Yeah, Ministry of Health. I am Daniel Joseph at protonmail.com. Send it out. I'll put you on the list.
Sorry, can I just go over your email just so that for me and other people that kind of were new on this, you can just verify. Is it IAM? And then D-A-N-I-E-L at, and the other part I didn't get, pro.
Joseph. I am Daniel Joseph. D-A-N-I-E-L-J-O-S-E-P-H at protonmail.com.
Proton, P-R-O-N-T-O-N?
P-R-O-T-O-N. Proton.
Oh, okay, P-R-O-T-O-N. Okay.
Yep, I am Daniel Joseph at protonmail.com. Now I'd like to go ahead and have us all mute out again, if you would, because the last speaker of the night has arrived. And, Bonnie, all I can say is take as long as you need to say whatever you need to say, and you're on. Bonnie.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Bonnie from Texas, and I wanted to say hello to everyone. There was a gentleman earlier that was talking, I believe it was Ed, who was talking about the administrative procedures on getting a judgment as a matter of law, which is exactly what we do. And the cool thing is we have, in Texas, we have established common law courts. The Republic of Texas, for which I work, I'm Counsel General for the Republic of Texas, and we operate under the Anti-Monopoly Clause, which is found in the Texas Bill of Rights, Article 1, Section 26, that says, you know, monopolies are forbidden, and the courts have a monopoly on their slaves, right? But the free man and women who have corrected their status and have gotten out of the slave system are entitled to a real court. So we have a remedy, since there aren't any more Article III courts except for maybe two in the whole country. All the other courts are Article I courts, which are created by the legislature, which is a violation of the separation of powers because you can't have one of the three entities, you know, like you can't have your legislative branch create the judicial branch because they're not creators. That's our job as we the people. Whatever power was not given to one of these three branches is retained by we the people. Well, what does that tell you? That the power begins with us. We have delegated certain powers and they're limited and they cannot morph into anything more than we have originally created. That which one, it's a maxim of law that which one creates, one controls. So really, we've gotten, I can't just say we, it's our forefathers. It was our mom and dad and our grandparents. They got busy working, and then they lost track of keeping the three branches under control. Because they operated in trust and they believed in them and they've morphed into something that they were never created to be. For example, the legislature cannot create the judicial branch. The judges have no ability to create law. They're not law creators, right? So that's a separation of powers issue. They're not allowed to create doctrines. You've heard the word, the doctrine of judicial immunity. Well, guess what that does? That's the judicial branch expanding their own power, and they're not authorized to do that because that power was never given to them to expand more power to their own branch or to expand more power to any of the other two branches, right? So what you see is power that's gone out of control, and really, it's on us. We have to train our civil servants to correct their governmental errors, right? We have to restrain them to know you have confines you have to stay within. There are no abilities for you to step outside your boundary box. So, for example, if you're suing a judge, you need to know how to do it, right? I have sued five judges in my county in federal court. I've already won in federal court once before. Now when we go to court, we do it the fast track way, which is send an affidavit of truth, just like the gentleman was speaking earlier. And I really liked his presentation. I don't know if he was one of the speakers. His name is Ed. But he was right on target because they will never rebut your affidavit of truth. And that affidavit of truth, only a living man can or woman can put truth on the record in the form of an affidavit. It's entitled to a judgment as a matter of law if it goes unrebutted. So what you do is you send, you know, the first, if you've been injured by someone, even if it's a judge, a DA, a sheriff, a deputy, doesn't matter. If you have been injured, you have a right to put that injury in written form, in the form of an affidavit. I'd send it over to the local sheriff's office, too, and put them on notice that, you know, because then when they don't do anything about it, you can start doing the Administrative Procedures Act on the sheriff and hold them accountable for neglect of duty, which is a cause of action in federal court. So what you do is you do an affidavit of truth point by point. It has to be rebutted point by point. If it's not, you're entitled to a judgment of law. So you send second notice, opportunity to cure. Your first notice, you're going to give them 30 days. I would do a cover letter, say, oh, by the way, see the following 50 facts here on the 10 pages attached. Every one of these facts need to be rebutted and sent back to me or I'm entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. So you're putting them on notice. pardon me. You're putting them on notice. Sorry, that's my call. Hold up. There we go. You're putting them on notice that they have an opportunity to cure the problem. When they don't, send them a second notice opportunity to cure. Give them 15 days. Send the affidavit of truth again. Put a cover letter with it that they defaulted. You're entitled to a judgment of law, but you're giving them a second opportunity. Why? Because you're a gracious boss. When they don't respond, you send them third notice opportunity to cure. You give them 7 days. When they don't respond, you send them notice of default. And you can take it in the federal court, or you can take it and start creating a common law court. If you are a living man and woman and you've corrected your status and you've gotten out of the slave system and you're no longer a 14th Amendment slave, and when I say slavery, I'm not trying to offend anyone. It's not about color. We're all on the slave ship together. And even the slave masters, many law enforcement and others who are civil servants don't even know that they're slave masters. They don't even know that the slave system is so complex that people do not even recognize that they're part of it, right? Even the wrongdoers, they're just following orders. How many times do we hear that from law enforcement? So if you've corrected your status and you've gotten yourself out, you're entitled to a common law court, of which, you know, they're few and far between, and we need to, as the different states start structuring those. Texas has them. It is easier if you've already done and gone through the Administrative Procedures Act, because typically we are going after civil servants for the injuries that they've done to us, whether it's searching, seizing, stealing property without a warrant, warrantless searches, all kinds of foolishness that they're doing. But you're entitled to relief, and you're entitled to a real Article III common law court. Well, we can't find one, right, because they're all Article I courts. But even that is fraud, because the legislative branch does not have the ability to create the judicial branch, which is exactly what's happened with our Article I courts. So, you know, there's a very dear friend of mine. Maybe you guys have heard of David Strait. He's a very well-known liberty lover, and he holds classes all over at the different nation states, and he teaches the stuff like how to correct your status. And when he gets a speeding ticket, he winds up making about $10,000 off of it. A police officer pulls him over, and he will send an affidavit of truth and wind up taking them into the Court of Claims in Washington, D.C., and getting their immunities removed, and wind up getting them to pay him $10,000 for every speeding ticket that he's given. And he's done it 3 or 4 times, but got $10,000 each time. This year. So there is a process to follow, and the Court of Claims is a good remedy, and you guys can, do that on a search engine. Just go in and look up, and there's forms you can fill out. They are the ones, if you go directly in the Court of Claims and add the United States as a defendant and send a letter with it. I know David has shared this process with me that he's done before, or he will send a letter in and say, oh, by the way, if you remove the immunities from that law enforcement officer or that judge, or whomever, I will let the United States out of this suit. And so sure enough, the higher court will not allow any immunities to be pled and remand it back to the lower court. So you have a higher court render it to a lower court, and the lower court has nowhere to go. They can't play the immunities doctrine. And what that does is the immunities are something that really, it is a long process. You start pleading immunity, and then you have to defend it. I mean, then you're acting like an attorney, and you're having to look up case law, and you're saying immunities don't count, and you've got to put on all this legal argument. Well, at the end of the day, you just want an immediate restitution for your injuries. So the Court of Claims is definitely a strong place to go. And David's had quite a bit of success by doing that, just on a traffic ticket. And, you know, in his state, he's up in Oregon, I believe, they're smart enough to leave him the heck alone. They don't mess with him anymore. You know, the judges tell the law enforcement, do not bring that man into my court, because they do not want they do not want to have to pay claims paid against them. But there are remedies, even in a common law court like we have down in Texas. We do the administrative procedures process, just like we talked about. They've got 30 days, then they've got 15, then they've got 7, then they get a notice of default, and then you take it into the common law court. By the way, the common law court is the highest finding of facts and conclusions of law that cannot be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. The common law court is the highest court in the land. It's even higher than the U.S. Supreme Court. How beautiful is that? So if you have the living men and women of your state that render a judgment and find these specific facts, guess what? You can take that common law court judgment, have it signed by 12 jurors and 3 notaries, and then you can file it, just another avenue of a remedy. Rather than take it in the court of claims, you can take it into any court. And in Texas, we have codified under the Uniform Foreign Judgment Enforcement Act, which is under the Civil Practices and Remedy Code, Chapter 35 and 36. And I would encourage you to read that. You probably have one in your state, too, if you're in Oklahoma, Kansas, you know, Delaware, New York, wherever everybody's from. You probably have that codified in your state codes as well. And again, the name of it is the Uniform Foreign Judgment Enforcement Act. Is everybody still there? I'm in a low cell area.
Yeah, we are here, Bonnie. Go right. You're doing really good. Go right ahead.
It's also codified in the federal code. So if you're familiar with the federal world of filing suits in federal court, you can also do it there. It's 28 U.S.C. 2467. And again, it's the same legislative created code that we can go ahead and enforce even in their de facto courts underneath the Uniform Foreign Judgment Enforcement Act. Why is it foreign? Because we are not a part of the corporation. The Republic of Texas Common Law Court is not a part of their corporation. That makes us foreign to them. Because we're foreign, we have the right to enforce our judgments as well. Many people heard about, I know it was a couple of years ago, that there were these Sharia courts for Muslim people up in Michigan. Did anybody hear about that beside me? And I love my Muslim brothers and sisters. You know, I'm not slanting that at all, but they've got Sharia law, which I may or may not agree with on it, and see if I would agree with what they're doing. But they have established their own Sharia law courts. How did they do that? But they've got their own courts established. So there is a remedy. And again, if a remedy is subverted or is unavailable to you, you have the right to put it in the form of an affidavit. Create your own remedy. You know, in the Texas Constitution Bill of Rights, it's Article 1, Section 13, which is a really rich, it is a really rich nugget because it's got multiple elements in it. It forbids cruel and unusual treatment. It guarantees that the courts are open, called the open courts provision of the Texas Constitution. And the closing part of that Bill of Rights that we have says this: you shall have a remedy by due course of law. Well, guess what? If you can't find one, then you're still entitled to a remedy. Where's my remedy, Judge? You know, I'm entitled to one. Here it is right here in my Bill of Rights. I'm entitled to a remedy if I've been injured. And you're blocking me with all your fraudulent judicial immunity doctrines. I'm entitled to a remedy. I'm entitled to injunctive relief. I'm entitled to restitution for the injuries because, let's say, for some people got their kids removed. No due process, no finding of parental unfitness. And all of a sudden, they're without their kids for years on end. Well, how do you repair somebody? Because an economic restoration is not enough, even though that is really the only remedy. how do you restore someone that can never get that time back with their kids, that cannot undo all that emotional pain caused by violating the fundamental foundation of your beautiful family? So you're entitled to a remedy. And if it's an irreparable irreparable injury, really the only remedy that you have that's equitable is a restitution award. So, and you're entitled to that in your Bill of Rights. So what I would encourage everyone, when you draft your pleadings and your affidavit of truth, you really want to meet the plead facts showing standard of Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 8, which is telling your story factually without any flavor or frivolity or without coming to labeled conclusions until you state your facts first. For example, your story might sound like this. You know, the average person is going to say, my Fourth Amendment rights were violated. Well, that's not enough. You just came to a legal conclusion. You have to plead facts showing that your Fourth Amendment rights were violated, right? So it might be something like this. Well, I was pulled over going down the highway 360 at 2 a.m. in the morning, and there were lights flashing behind me, and all of a sudden a police officer, when I bring my car to a stop, is at my window side, and he's telling me to get to my car, and he's got a gun pulled at me, and I ask him what's the problem, and he won't tell me. And as soon as I get out of the car, under the threat of death, with a gun pulled to my head, he winds up touching me in places that he shouldn't touch and taking me to jail. And I keep asking the officer, what have I done? What's wrong? What are you doing? Give me a search warrant. And I served time, 30 days in the local county jail. I'm just using this as an example of plead facts showing. I spent time in the local county jail for 30 days. I was never told what the charges against me were. There was no search warrant. And then you can come to the conclusion at the end of your affidavit of truth, my Fourth Amendment rights were violated. And it's a power pack sentence to say this. The Fourth Amendment December 15, 1791.
You broke up, darling. Can you repeat that, please?
1791.
Yeah, it's still breaking up. You might want to put your finger in the air and twirl around.
Yeah, I'm in a low cell coverage area. I might try.
There, it came back. Go ahead now.
So the plead facts showing that you've been injured in your Fourth Amendment rights and that your Fourth Amendment rights have been clearly established since December 15, 1791 is a power pack statement, because the only defense in federal court that anybody can plead is what's called federal qualified immunity. That's the only one that can stand up in federal court. And federal qualified immunity is a very tiny sliver of immunity that they can legitimately plead, and here's how it's phrased. And this is for their judges in their case law. It says if a code or statute was not clearly established at the time, then they can plead federal qualified immunity, right? But when you, in your pleading, say, by the way, Fourth Amendment has been clearly established since December 15, 1791, and was clearly enforced at the time, you just trust what they may have tried to plead, and then they're just blocked from either place because you've already put them in a place where they can't even plead federal qualified immunity. You've already set it up that way originally. So it's a really strong statement to make that the Fourth Amendment was clearly established at the time of December 15, 1791, so I would definitely add that. I hope that's helpful. Are you still there?
Oh, yes, we're all still here, hanging at the seat of our pants, Bonnie.
Hanging by the seat of your pants, hanging on the edge of your seat, okay. Does anybody have any questions? I mean, there's a lot to share when you're talking about pleading in federal court for your civil rights violations.
What part of Texas are you in?
We're in the Dallas area.
Dallas area. Well, this is John. I'm about 70 miles east of you out here by Lake Fork. We should have lunch sometime.
Oh, great. I'm from the Republic of Texas, and that's what we're doing. We're setting the people free from a slave system. And it's a beautiful thing because people are waking up to their rights being continually violated, and they want to be free. I hope I don't lose, just stepped into an elevator.
Looks like we lost Bonnie for a minute there. I sent a text request. You're cutting in and out. Go ahead.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just in the elevator. Well, there's more on that, but, I was just teaching at our Republic of Texas congressional session at my office on Saturday, and, there's so much to share that it's really kind of hard to do at this late hour at night, especially after everybody's already invested so much time and energy in listening and talking on the call, but I talked for 3 hours on Saturday and could have kept going. One of the things that we all need to know how to do is to write a writ of habeas corpus just in case we're confined or someone that we love is confined. And confinement does not have to be that your body is in jail. You could be administratively confined in your liberty somehow, and all of a sudden you're not able to do something that you need to do, whether it's just COVID foolishness that they're doing where they're confining your loved ones and they're not letting you sit by your loved one's side while they're in the hospital suffering alone and causing a catastrophe with their mental state because they can't recover as well as they could if they had their loved one by their side. And there's somebody I know that's dealing with that very issue, and that's a term of it's a form of confinement that a writ of habeas corpus will resolve, because it's any kind of confinement, right? You're confined in your ability to, under the First Amendment, it's four prongs. You have the right of religion, you have freedom of association, you have the right of free speech and press, and you have a right to redress your grievances under that First Amendment. So that right of association is important, right? You have the right to sit by your loved one's side if they were in the hospital. Why are they not letting people in? Because they're giving them the wrong protocols and they're dying. That's happening. It's happening all over our nation.
It's not wrong protocols. They're doing what they intend to do, and that's to kill people.
Right.
That
it's a wrong
the protocol in and of itself is a death sentence. No
it's
question, no doubt.
Remdesivir is a killer drug, just like AZT was.
Correct.
Yep. Remdesivir is causing all kinds of kidney disorders, and people are dying from the fluid back up in their own body. And then after they give them the remdesivir, then they're not giving them the kidney dialysis or kidney treatments that they need to do. But,
go ahead, Bonnie.
That remdesivir, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going by rumor, something I heard, that it was something that Fauci put out and said, this is your only protocol to follow.
It's on the CDC webpage.
Yeah, and
correct.
What? First of all, CDC is a corporation, and it's not the fifth branch of government. We have never given that kind of power to any branch of government, as well as the CDC, that's just a corporation. And here's something else, a nugget of truth for everybody to put in their pocket. In 1978, there was a civil rights violation that happened, and somebody was able to sue a corporation, and the U.S. Supreme Court came out with a wonderful decision called Monell versus Department of Social Services. I believe it's spelled M-O-N-E-L-L. Versus Department of Social Services, meaning you can sue any corporation for their unconstitutional policies And it does not have to be a written policy. It can be a de facto policy that they're actually following. It's not even in written form anywhere, but it is endorsed by the leaders of that company. So, for example, CDC is a business. It's a corporation. It's not even government. So why the hell are they pretending like they're government and telling governments what to do? You're right. It's a genocide agenda, and it has no business being given any honor by we the people. We really need to put the CDC out of business and tell them we will have none of this. They're not the fifth branch of government. They're not government at all. They're nothing but, you know, a bunch of power mongers that want to slaughter. Here we are in Germany all over again, just like it was in the 1940s. They're out to kill this genocide. But that's a whole other topic. But you do have the right under a Monell plan.
Thank you for that, by the way, Bonnie. I actually, that's something that's timely for me and something I'm putting together right now. But while I got you paused for a second, you mentioned that you're tired. I can hear you're in a motel. You've been very busy. We're so appreciative of your energy tonight, distracted as it might have been. I sent you a text. Now I'm going to put you in spot in front of the House of Prayer. Will you do our next House of Prayer call where you're fresh and come on and speak? I know that there's some people that have already texted me and said they really liked you. Thumbs up. Will you do our September 2nd call? Do you have freedom on your calendar for that?
September 2nd. I should.
Thursday night, 6:30 sharp, and we'll be sitting there waiting on you, so it can't be one of those things. I'll be there at 7 or 7:15 because the whole audience is going to be waiting on you Thursday night. Would that work?
That should be fine.
Would everybody like that? I mean, do we have any dissent? I mean, come on now.
Bonnie, this is Ed in Georgia. I'm one of the thumbs up. I wanted to talk to you because you're in Texas, and we have a client down in Denton. Do you know where Denton, Texas is?
Yeah, of course. They're about an hour away from us.
Okay. Well, they're one of the most corrupt counties in your state. So the reason I wanted to talk to you about the client is because we had a client that got locked up on a capious warrant from a judge, and we put in a habeas corpus. We called the federal marshal. The sheriff wouldn't allow the client to accept documents to get his habeas corpus, so we filed it for him. And I found out through the clerk that they have statutory rules that say that they can take up to 10 days to process a habeas corpus. The problem with that was we put in a non-statutory writ of habeas corpus.
Okay.
You know how habeas works. Yeah, I mean it's got to be. They got to be seen within 72 hours.
Yeah. Well.
But that's not happening even in Texas. I wanted to make that. And I'm gonna share my non-statutory writ of habeas corpus with Daniel, and I've already told him to send you some of my documents.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we all need to know how to write a writ of habeas corpus. And you know what?
Yes,
if they don't grant it, you do a writ of mandamus. And you know what? If they don't grant that, you take them before a common law court and you have their butts arrested because they're acting as treasonous common law tortfeasors and they need to be behind bars. And
is that going to be your subject for next week, Bonnie? Are you going to talk about habeas corpus with us?
We need to, yes. We need to have a whole class on that.
I would enjoy hearing that. I think you sound like you're sharp. You just did the Republic of Texas 3 hours. I'm certain you did that off the cuff. You have time to prepare between now and the 2nd of September. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Oh, one more thing I want to mention about the federal marshal in Texas. When we called him and told him what the problem was, we sent it. We filed into federal district court. The district court clerk said that because of COVID, that they couldn't bring the habeas corpus before, like, I think she said 38 days. This guy was locked up for 180 days.
They have and you know what, the sad thing is this could happen to any of us. They have an absolute ministerial duty to do it within 72 hours, I believe. And
they do.
The very fact
they do.
That they're using COVID as an excuse is not acceptable. And that, you know, they need to be arrested because now you've got them for neglect of duty, and then you've got them also under Texas Penal Code 39.02 and 39.03, official oppression, abuse of office, as well as it's a constitutional right under Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution, and in Texas we have it codified in the Texas Bill of Rights under Article 1, Section 12. And I know every state has their Bill of Rights numbered differently, but that's what we have in Texas. So I hope that this information has been a blessing to everyone, not that, you know, we have 3 hours to speak on the phone tonight, but, you know, there's we all have different experiences, and we're all being encumbered, and the freer my people are, the freer I am, right? So I'm here to serve. That's, you know, I don't get paid as Counsel General for the Republic of Texas. I don't get a salary. I serve because it's the right thing to do, and I want my people free, and God's put that on my heart. This is a God movement. And, you know, when Jesus died on that cross 2,000 years ago, he died to set us free, and we're entitled to freedom. We are not slaves.
Amen.
We are not
Amen.
Other men's property.
Thank you so much for that encouragement, Bonnie. We are looking forward to next Thursday night. Do you mind if I open it up generally for questions right now so you can take a breath and take a little break here and see if there's anybody in the listening audience that's just got something they want to question the group from before we close our Thursday night call?
Sure.
Anybody out there that's got a question on their heart that needs to be answered and they're in a situation right now, listen to the crowd that you have here, the people that are on this call. If you can't get an answer here, I know you're not going to get it from a liar. So any questions out there?
Yeah. Okay, I hear him.
We hear you. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going through a case right now where I did the 1099A and things of that nature, and appoint them trustees. I did a lot of stuff. Like, when I say a lot of stuff, I mean a lot of stuff. I used to shut court cases down with just a letter rogatory and a Form 56.
Okay.
Well, the case is at is in Kentucky. I even did a judicial complaint, which goes to the judicial board. They said that they was going to get back in August or whatever. And I asked them when. They said they couldn't tell me what day. And they appointed an attorney. I fired the attorney verbally and in writing, and they continued to have the attorney on the case. They revoked my bond because I gave them an invoice, all parties involved. They revoked the bond and said that I'm a threat to society. They tried to send me to get a psych evaluation because I go in there, I don't argue with them. Only thing I do is ask them questions. That's it. I don't argue.
No, that's great. That's how it should be.
Nothing like
that. You're operating as king. Go ahead.
Correct. And this case has been going on since July of last year. I was let out on an OR bond previous. The police officer lied in the affidavit, quote unquote, because we know that can't testify and be a witness at the same time. He lied in the affidavit and said that the vehicle, I'm going to call it vehicle, I'm just going to use their terms, that it was in someone else's name, but it was actually in the trust name. And one of the attorneys said on the record that it was in a trust name, and that the police officer said that I got the recording on that. They lied and pretty much the whole time. And I asked the judge on the record, who was the accuser, may I cross-examine the accuser? And, you know, I told him I repent if I caused harm to any of my fellow brother or sisters, you know, a man or woman, to come forth so I can apologize to him. I love every man and every woman and according with the law. he who has loved his neighbor have fulfilled the law. And I do everything in honor with God and with the Almighty. So he yelled and screamed. He said, there's no one to apologize to. There's no one you cause harm to. Why you keep saying that? And I said on the record, for the record, if there's no one that any harm has been caused, I demand that this court be dismissed without prejudice. And then, you know, how they yell and all that. Like I said, I don't get out of my character of yell back or nothing like that. I just stay calm the whole time. Like I said, they continue to bring me in to try to pretty much harm me or whatever. But I did a writ of court warranto and defaulted them out. Now, I was hearing someone talk about a declaratory judgment. Now, with that declaratory judgment, how would that play in a role if once you default them out? And how long do they have to sign off that order or grant that order?
You know, declaratory judgment, what I have learned about it, and I've never done one, that summary judgment is probably where you want to go, because summary judgment, where you put all the affidavits of truth in that you've done, it goes unrebutted. You're the one that's entitled to summary judgment. Declaratory judgment, my understanding is that it's discretionary, meaning they don't even have to rule at all on a declaratory judgment. But when you file against, say, you know, Sam Smith, police officer of Denton County, you know what I mean, go ahead and sue the county, the sheriff and the deputy, and you can include the state of too if you know that the state of Texas has been neglectful or has a pattern and practice of not holding their state agents culpable or trained properly. Failure to train is a cause of action in federal court. But you can put the affidavits of truth three times, gone unrebutted, then send them a notice of default. If you can't get restitution in the federal court under summary judgment when the other side has never responded, that means you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. That's a maxim of law. And you just take them in under summary judgment and redress your grievances. And be sure to put them on notice of that, how much you are entitled to, because everybody's number's different. Like, you know, if they search and seize your car, somebody may say, oh, it's only worth $10,000. Somebody else may say, oh, heck no, my car, my freedom's worth $150. So put them on notice how much the value of your rights are worth and what you're entitled to. Because, again, you get to create your own remedy if one's been subverted or hidden from you. Take it in under summary judgment after you've done your administrative process on them. They have nowhere to go. They can't win. You know, my buddy,
they're already in default.
Yeah, they're already in default. They've already lost. They've already lost because they're never going to respond to truth because they're a bunch of liars. And they can't put truth on the record. It's my understanding that they just always operate in lies. So I wanted to praise you because I can hear that you know what you're doing. And when you're standing in court, you're operating in equity, which means you trump the judge. When you start talking about the Bible, the Word of God, the judges have nowhere to go. I mean, you just went to the highest archy of the creator of law, creator of heaven and earth. They cannot touch you. When you start quoting scripture, they have nowhere to go. They're like roaches when the lights go on. They have to flee, right? So it's amazing what one light, and it could be your life, an example to others. Think about lighting a match in a dark closet. It lights up that whole dark closet, right? So we never know the lives that we touch, including, I believe, with all my heart, that you're able to flip some of those nefarious characters that are working as civil servants because they don't know what righteousness looks like. And I believe with all my heart it is our duty to show them. And sometimes it's just us being examples of what righteousness is. So I want to praise you, brother, for exalting God's word when you go into the courthouse because there's so much power, and if people knew, they would use it way more often than what they do. So thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
anybody else out there that's got something that they need addressed, I mean, we're coming around to almost 4 hours.
One more question. When okay. you say the federal court, are you talking about U.S. District or what are you when you say federal?
Yeah, what I like about the U.S. District Court, which is federal, they are over in the hierarchy, higher over the state courts. There's so much fraud happening in the states. I do also like the fact that all the pleadings are done in written form. You don't have to do a whole lot of oral argument. And when you do written, it can be stronger because any time we get up to speak, we can always have those, oh, man, I should have said this and I didn't, or I should have said that and I forgot. You know, but when we have time to write, we can really compress, we can really squeeze those pleadings tight and succinctly so that when they are read by whomever, judge or magistrate's going to read them, they're tight and compressed and they're full of truth. And you have time, you know, typically it's a 30-day process in between one party and then the other party gets to respond within 21 days or 30 days. But, you know, I like it better. Because, again, you have more time and you do it in written form. And you're also creating a record, too. So there's not really the same fee and expense that you would in state court of having those oral arguments and having a real expensive transcript of $5,000 for a 3-day hearing. You know what I mean? Because you already have all the pleadings. And anyway, for that reason, I also believe that federal court is the correct venue, especially if you're going up against a U.S. citizen and you're an American national, you've already corrected your status. You don't belong in their state courts anymore, in their fraud Article I courts. You belong in a common law court, and you're going to find that in the federal, but you have to call it out. You have to say, hey, I demand an Article III judge. I'm not going to deal with a magistrate. I want my Article III judge, which I'm entitled to as a living man. Anyway, it's great talking to everybody. It's getting late, so I'm gonna go if that's okay with everyone.
Well, we're about ready to wrap up too. Anyway, Bonnie, I'm usually a real stickler about wrapping it up early, but with such a lineup, I want to thank all my guests that came here tonight: Dave, Ed, John, Glenn, Bonnie. My gosh, what a night tonight! Thank you for the people that shared your experience, Kirkland and Harold, and if I missed you, it wasn't on purpose. I love you all. This has been a wonderful House of Prayer call. Let's just go ahead and close it down and give praise to God for our wonderful evening. Can we do that together and agree to meet on the second day of September?
Be willing.
Lord willing, we'll see you then. Good night, everybody. Have a great evening.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Daniel, are you there?